and welcome to episode 113 of the Creighton Crowbar PC Gaming Podcast, now with extra plosives and a beautiful sound thanks to you, our Patreon backers, who have purchased us. Listen to those pops that you can't hear. We've got pop shields.
You can't. So there.
And with your lovely money, we have bought ourselves lots of sound equipment. And so hopefully you can hear the difference. And if you can't, your ears are fucked. So I am the hopefully mellifluous Marsh Davis. And I'm joined this evening by the exceptionally clear and crisp Chris Thurston.
Yelling Chris Thurston.
The sonorous syllables of Tom Senior.
Why, hello.
And the ferocious fricatives, Tom Francis.
I don't even know what a fricative is. Hello.
It's a
oh, okay.
Beautiful fricative.
I do say that a lot.
We are abusing this right that we've been bought.
Anyway, the news this week, other than our amazing sound, which you can definitely appreciate and was definitely worth the money, is that Far Cry Primal has been announced. Badly, but it has been announced.
Yeah.
Far Primal.
Yeah, they did a live stream announcement that started, I think it was about 8 p.m. last night or something, and everyone was watching it on tenterhooks, and nothing happened that evening. It just kind of zoomed in on some cave art. And then I woke up this morning and it was still going and still nothing had been announced. And it just had like 6,000 downvotes on YouTube. Oh, really? But the actual news of what happened, of what it is, was leaked by IGN Turkey in a tweet. Just the name, I think. And then at some point an image and some info came out, but I don't know what happened. Maybe did press already know and there was an embargo? And
I think Polygon probably knew because they had... they were pretty quick on putting up some kind of special embedded behind the scenes video.
Right. Mm. And it's, what is it?
Caveman.
Far Cry. But you know how you like the bow? Well, I'll get used to using the bow a lot.
And remember how you really didn't like all the fussy crafting shit killing animals endlessly. Mm. It's that!
But yeah, what they show in the trailer is killing a mammoth.
Mm.
It's very, I noticed almost every scene in the trailer is you and like three or four other dudes hunting with you. Mm. Hunting wild animals, getting attacked by a saber-toothed tiger, and then right at the end being attacked by an enemy tribe.
Mm.
You know how there are loads of super shonky kind of prehistoric / dinosaur survival games on Steam that do really, really well all the time, even though they're total shit. What if a company with loads of money made an actual version of one?
Yeah, I'm co-op? Slightly worried that they are jumping on that bandwagon. Mm. You know, they seem to, I mean, in the behind the scenes video, they mentioned survival like 8 times and mentioned crafting. Mm. And like, oh, don't become a surviving crafting game. I don't want to do that.
It's Assassin's Creed Syndicate recently revealed their extensive crafting systems as well.
Jesus.
Make a hood out of, I don't know, peasants' hides. Don't know how it works.
How are they going to do, 80% of the things that people expect there to be in a Far Cry game? Unless this really is, you know, the kind of we genuinely are rebooting it and it's now a survival crafting woodland game.
Yeah, there's not really any hang gliding in it.
Yeah, there's probably not. There's
maybe animal skin hang glider crafted out of woolly mammoths.
Probably not going to be a turret sequence.
There's probably going to be some kind of psychological woo-woo element to it, isn't there? There's probably going to be some kind of tribal spirit reality which you can go to, which also
phase
somehow
shift into the primal dimension.
Yeah, you'll fall through a time portal
and
to
charge your primal meter.
There are jeeps and stuff.
Yeah, you'll eat the weird peyote and dream of like a fucking hind Russian attack helicopter for a bit.
It's funny that they've had some kind of chemical thing or some kind of delusionary thing in every game since Far Cry 2. In Far Cry 2, it's just malaria. And in the subsequent ones, it's been drug trips.
I do wonder how they're going to allow you to play a caveman who is also a sort of disaffected youth.
on holiday.
Exploring his roots in, you know, cavemania or wherever he's from.
What item of iconic clothing? Can they possibly market Loin for it? Almost naked.
Yeah.
Iconic tooth necklace.
Yeah.
I bet there'll be some pre-order exclusive unlockable club. Golden club.
Well, the behind the scenes video had loads and loads of different clubs made out of different bits of animal bone, and the guy making it, who did not necessarily totally not resemble a caveman with the amount of hair he had, was very enthusiastic about using, you know, ligaments and stuff to make weapons.
Well, I mean, do you think there's going to be outposts?
Well, there's going to be other tribes, isn't
there?
Mammoth outposts, manned by mammoths.
Because the premise is that you're reuniting your tribe, right?
Well, I think I get the impression from the context, this might be inaccurate, but that the trailer represents the one of the opening sections of the game, and because you see yourself getting your tribe being split apart by an attack of an animal, right? You're hunting mammoth, and then this saber-toothed tiger comes happening? Up, and it seems like you might somehow get separated from anybody else, but you end up.
Who would have thought that would happen in a video game?
Yeah, you end up on your own in a savage land, says a Frenchman. Not getting up to term with latest politically correct terminology.
I just processed it as like a disjointed series of clips. I didn't realize it was telling me a story.
Yeah, well, maybe it
is
wasn't.
Is there going to be a dinosaur in it?
There will, if there isn't, there will be a dinosaur in like the first DLC pack, which will be like the Valley of the Yeti thing they did Far Cry 4.
Yeah. That's where they do the mythological stuff, I guess.
Yeah, it'll be very... How are they going to do the charismatic, very well mo-capped villain who mo-caps at you from a position of philosophical authority, if not moral authority, for 5 minutes?
And what language is he going to speak?
Seems like there isn't a... It's not going to be subtitled, judging by the...
You do hear them talk, don't you? But they're... Unrecognisable language.
What are they speaking in? Does anyone know?
Probably made up. Probably Simlish.
The most ancient of all languages.
Presumably we don't have any data on the actual languages they spoke, like, in the phonetic way.
Probably not, not 10,000 years ago, no.
I'm trying to think what a caveman could possibly get sort of... could posture about philosophically at you while sort of trying to espouse some kind of Nietzschean... kind of worldview. Mm. Like, do you know what the definition of insanity is? It's not hiding from the spooky shadow.
Yeah. But I don't know. I'm glad that they're not ploughing the exact same furrow forever and ever.
Yeah.
Because it did feel like, from 3 and 4, that they'd found their niche and they were going to stick to it. But,
yeah. I'm sort of... not massively excited about it for some reason. I don't really... I guess I just need to see what the game is. Like, what do you actually do?
Yeah.
I think with stealth games particularly, especially sort of freeform, you either need really, really good AI, loads of, like, gadgets and tools and options, or ideally both. Like, you know, stealth with only a very limited tool set, which would be heavily implied if, like, the majority of the items in the game are variants on clubs and spears and bows. You need to have like some kind of amazing underlying AI system, presuming that you're going to spend some time raiding neighboring villages or whatever in a kind of outposty sort of way. That would be my concern. Like, you know, Far Cry is all about, like, I stuck C4 to this thing and then the jeep span over the thing and then it hit a deer and the deer bolted and the deer attracted a bear. And like half of that vocabulary isn't really possible if it's like I fired an arrow at a man and then... I hid in a bush and then I crafted a club.
Yeah, true.
Interested to see how the scale of the world holds up, because Far Cry has always been built around vehicles, and that obviously allows you to cover vast distances very quickly. But unless you could just hop on a tiger and jet off to another place, then I don't know. It's going to be a significant kind of redesign of the kind of topology.
This is my bet that you're going to realize pretty soon on that you're in like a hidden valley that has actually just survived in the Neolithic period until pretty much the present day, or like the 1950s or something like that.
It's a massive fake out. No, it just turns into Far Cry 5.
Oh yeah, the 1950s caveman genre.
Yeah, there's a perspective switch where a kind of baffled Gapier student parachutes down to the middle of the map and you control him instead.
Well, because that's the kind of thing that has happened in previous Far Cry games, where you go to a place which has somehow kind of fallen back into savagery, but now you are playing it, but from the indigenous people of that area's perspective, right?
Turns out to be entirely set in like Cheddar Gorge.
What have you been doing this weekend, Chris?
What have I been doing? I spent this weekend at European Road to BlizzCon 2015 in Prague, in the Czech Republic.
How was that road?
Well, the thing is, it's confusing because the Road to BlizzCon refers to the esports side of Blizzard stuff. So all of the Hearthstone and Heroes of the Storm and World of Warcraft PvP, which is still a really active thing with a big community, judging by this event, earning their place to compete internationally at BlizzCon later in the month. But it's also basically the closest thing that Europe's going to get to a BlizzCon, particularly Eastern Europe, I guess, somewhere you go if you're massively enthusiastic about those games. And as somebody who has been to BlizzCon and been very impressed by how passionate that community is, that it's like a, or it's about like a, or, you know, feels like an E3 Gamescom style event dedicated to a single company's four games that has way more passion and creativity to it. But with that in mind, the event itself, in terms of organization and stuff, was one of the most bizarrely poorly thought out consumer event experiences I've ever seen. The best example of this, I tweeted it, maybe put a link in the show notes to the picture, was the Heroes of the Storm main stage, because I know you watched the games online, and I'm 90% certain you had a much better experience of watching those games online than you would have done watching them live, where they built a stage for an eSport where if you sat in the central 70% of the audience, it was impossible to see the game that was being played. You could hear the commentary and see the players physically,
right,
but had no way of seeing what they were doing, because they put both game broadcasting screens far off to the sides of the stage, where only the very, very extreme flanks of the audience could see them, which is about as close to fucked it as I've ever seen one an esports organizer get it, as apart from like the real disaster events where it turns out the entire thing was a scam or whatever, which this wasn't. And it's about as close as I've seen to Blizzard do a real kind of like, well, we didn't think about this. Like, everyone walked into the arena and thought, maybe they're going to drop a screen down from the ceiling or something, because there really is clearly a space there where a big screen should be if anyone's going to see anything. And they didn't. So that was weird.
Chris actually showed me that picture in the office and said, what's up? What's wrong with this stage? And I was like, look at it, what's on it? And I was like, he was very patient. And I was like, nothing. Exactly. <Yes.
laughs> beautiful set dressing, there. Amazing lighting, incredible, you know, displays to show team logos dynamically and the different teams and lighting that would indicate whether which one team was red or blue on the map and that kind of thing, but no screen.
Damn.
Yeah.
Quite so that was so that was part of it. It was also the first time I've seen Heroes of the Storm played as a an eSport properly, really, as part of one or two toes dipped into it. And, actually, Marsh, I'm kind of more interested to know what you thought of that, because you're the one who knows the game inside out.
What did I think
of watching HOTS as a competitive enterprise?
Well, as in, so in terms of this particular presentation of it, or how it stacks up as an eSport in general.
Just, did you enjoy it? You know, did you?
Oh yeah, I had a great day. I mean, but, you know, I was slightly hungover. I just ate bacon all day and watched eSports.
Sounds great.
I was quite ashamed by the end of the day, but it was basically,
yeah, that's my life now.
Yeah, I think I said to Pip, I think I rank watching esports probably above Netflix but below really any social interaction with another human, which is fine.
I know, that's the tagline for my new site.
Better than Netflix, worse than any human interaction.
But I don't know if that was just the way it was presented. I think I enjoyed all the games that were played. I don't think they were necessarily played to the kind of high level I was expecting. Like, I was expecting just to sit there, not really understand anything that was going on, just be amazed by people's fucking amazing micro skills or crazy strats. And really, there are a couple of things that surprised me, but on the whole, though, it seemed, you know, they just looked like ordinary HOTS games, really, and they made quite a lot of mistakes, which is quite weirdly gratifying. But I don't know.
I think it was interesting because it very quickly became a game that was about making mistakes, because I think they are obviously very good at it, and they actually make very few mistakes relative to how many you might be expected to make playing for lots of money on a stage under high-pressure circumstances against people who are going to punish mistakes very hard. But because they don't make very many mistakes, the game feels very passive for a long time. There were moments where teams would run into each other and everyone's using these huge, flashy abilities and they're trying to kick the shit out of each other and then nobody dies and everyone moves. Because healing is very, very powerful in HOTS, far more so than in other games of that type. And it scales much further than relative to the amount of damage characters can do and the amount of stuns they can do. So, and, you know,
I think that might have felt a lot more gratifying. I think it's definitely a flaw in the game, like in terms of how they signal healing particularly. Like, it's just not very visible.
Massively impactful.
But you don't see where people are getting healed from or what's causing it. When you're looking at it, there's a massive, you know, mosh pit going on and people just walk away with these kind of health bars that are pretty much back up to max. You're like, I didn't really see why that occurred. You know, it's not that easily kind of possible.
It's because a distant orc has winked at them and given them all their health back.
Yeah.
With that in mind, like, I don't want to be too cynical about it. I was quite bored. but partly my bigger concern was that a lot of the game, especially towards the middle section of the tournament, came down to somebody fucking up and being punished for it ultimately to the loss of the game, rather than like a team going, okay, this is evenly matched. We need to do something big and dramatic in order to, and clever to break the game open. It would be more often like, let's not do something clever because the last time anyone tried anything clever, that team lost. So let's stay here and edge around each other on the map and try and claim objectives. And then you could see it, like the psychological side of it, where the teams would go like, oh, but if we make the play now, if our Johanna, the big, you know, chunky crusader from Diablo who can pull everybody together to a central spot, runs into them now and grabs their entire team together, then we can pile on top of them and use all our abilities and they've all been healed and now we've lost. And that would happen over and over again. And it actually did change at the end when Na'Vi, the team that won and won, didn't lose an entire game in the entire tournament, did just pull out a completely off the meta strat with no tanks and all the rest of it and do something quite different. And that was really entertaining to watch, but it took a while to get there. But it felt like for a long time that it had become a game about, you know, inching around each other until one person gets slightly out of position. And
well,
then
it's surprising there was a couple of games where, teams just did the wrong thing, but over and over again. Yeah, like there's a boss on each level. There's two bosses in some levels, and you can go and attack them. Once you attack them and defeated them, they become yours. Hmm. But you're very vulnerable while you're in that attacking phase because the boss is throwing damage at you, and you can be ambushed by the enemy team. And it's very easy for them to kind of wipe you and then turn the boss to their side before it's down. And like that happened, and then it happened again, and then the team that seemed to win that time made the same mistake and got punished for it, and then it happened again. I was just like, what are you doing? Why have you not learned anything?
It's weird, because the other thing is, like, if you will, you know, I've gotten back into playing HOTS, I should say that, like, I really am enjoying it again as a game. Hmm. And when you play HOTS, and maybe it's just a traditional MOBA thing, but you get used to the idea that everyone goes to a different lane, you know? You split up at the start, and it's asymmetrical in some way. But professional HOTS is 5-man almost all of the time. Like,
there were a few matches where they had characters who could soak by splitting into, you know, different groups, or there was an Abathur who could soak on one lane while kind of controlling on another. But on the whole, pretty much by, I don't know, 5 minutes in, they were roaming as a 5-man.
They would start as a 5 because it's that thing of like that first pickoff means a lot. So you start as a 5 on the off chance that the other team hasn't done that. Because if they haven't done that and one of their team is actually on their own, that person's totally giga fucked. and then, you know, then, so the response to that is both teams go as 5. Mm. And so it's, I don't know, there's something that needs to slightly change in the meta just to encourage teams to break up a bit more and, you know, try things as individuals. Cause I think that was the thing, is I came away from it with no particular sense of the personality of any individual players. I got a sense of what teams were like, but not a sense of like, oh, that guy. You know, that guy, he did this one thing off on his own. It was really ballsy. But that might well be me.
I think they may be changing it to the opposite effect of that, actually, because the new patch, I think, it's hit today, actually, is going to lower the difference between levels in the early game. So there's probably going to be less advantage for you laning and earning XP that way.
Hmm.
Hmm.
Do they have StarCraft there?
They did. They had a StarCraft show match, which was, because I think the StarCraft tournaments are held separately, because I think partly because they don't need regional championships for StarCraft, because there is literally one non-Korean in the top 26.
Wow.
Right. Like the top 16 for BlizzCon is 15 South Koreans and one French guy, who's 13th and who is playing like the first top seeded player in the world in this first game in the elimination. Yeah. So that's probably why there wasn't like a European regional championship, because it's one guy. But there was a StarCraft Legacy of the Void show match, which was kind of a bit of a marketing exercise to show off the new game. Mm. But it was played in Archon mode, which is the one where two players control the same base and same army. But it was that French guy, and it was two different StarCraft. They were teammates, as in they're in the same StarCraft team, but obviously it's an individual game. And they were playing together. And it was very one-sided. It was a best of three, but it only went to two games. Because one team, I think Team Liquid, had two players that are both Zerg players. And the other team was the best European player, the best non-South Korean player in the world, who's a Protoss player, with his teammate, who's a Terran player. So they played Terran, I think, assuming that they needed to play like the weaker player's side. but it was, yeah, very uneven, because it turns out having two Zerg players in one Zerg base is just a massive advantage.
Right, because their creep benefits you lower and stuff like that.
But they know the game. They know Zerg inside out, so right. they can, you know, they're not having any trouble with that. But they did make jokes about it. Like, one guy had just been assigned to paint the map with Zerg creep, because you need quite a lot of micro. It's a micro task that, which it's spreading the Zerg, you know, morass across the ground that gives them a bonus, is a micro task that most players don't prioritize beyond a certain point, because there's a million other things you could be doing. But when you have two people, two brains occupying the same body, basically, you can just assign one guy to, like, colouring in the map, and it was absurd. Like, he was, like, soaking half of it in thing. The other thing that was really funny is when all of a sudden they had four evolution chambers, which is too many evolution chambers, and you could tell exactly what had happened. But one of them had said, I think we need to get two evolution chambers, and they'd both immediately built two evolution chambers, which is the kind of, like, I think Pip described it as a pantomime horse, and there is an element of comedy pantomime horse to Archon mode, Legacy of the Void. But I think they wanted to push that mode and kind of stress some new stuff, so it didn't really feel like a competitive electric sport.
What was the other thing you saw there?
The other thing, the best thing about the weekend, the thing that really like saved the entire experience for me, as a sort of, yeah, as a something I traveled for, was Overwatch, which I played a whole bunch of, and Overwatch is fucking great.
What is Overwatch, Chris?
So Overwatch is the when it was announced, people compared it to TF2, and that's pretty accurate. It's a first-person team-based competitive game with a heavy focus on objectives. There's a lot of enemy territory in it as well, in terms of progression of objectives. In fact, map design-wise, maybe we should get to the start of the basics, but it is probably more enemy territory than it is Team Fortress.
Okay.
To a degree, at least. And it's also got a substantial element of the MOBA to it, in that its characters are, rather than being classes, like a spy, a scout, a soldier, are actual, like, they're like MOBA-style people with names and so on, who have ultimate abilities and a selection of powers sort of that are completely unique to them, and there's no crossover in either weapons or abilities between characters. And yeah, and I remember seeing it announced at BlizzCon last year and thought it looked cool, but wasn't really expecting much from it. Like, I hadn't followed it very much. And I was mega impressed by it. And to pick that apart, so my first experience with it was jumping into a game, in a sort of, you know, a demo setting, so kind of with strangers, where I decided to play a character who looked relatively simple. So I pick up this character called Zarya, who is this kind of like space marine kind of character, big Russian space marine, power armor with this huge kind of like plasma gun. And you sort of have a chance in the preamble to sort of find out what she does. And I'm immediately surprised that you can't switch weapons. There is no weapon switching. For most characters, you just have one gun.
Wow.
And that is your character's gun. And it maybe has two fire modes, or it doesn't, depending on the character. And it's all, I think they feel a lot of freedom because they designed the guns specifically for the characters that will carry them. There's a lot of freedom to kind of like completely tie them all together in how the abilities work. So Zarya is pretty simple. She's primary fire is like a kind of linear laser cannon. Secondary fire is like a kind of plasma lob grenade thing that, a bit like the flat. But like the secondary fire and the flat cannon in Unreal Tournament, consumes more ammo to fire, but is from the same clip. And then every character has three abilities other than that. One on E, one on left shift, and one on Q. Which feels weird at first, but actually it's quite natural because those are all buttons you use a lot in shooters for other things. And one of them can be mapped for the right mouse button if your gun doesn't have a secondary fire. So, hers are quite simple actually, because her shift and her E are actually the same ability targeted differently. So she has a shield that she can place on herself with shift, or on an ally temporarily with E. So it's just a basic support thing, and the game is super good about explaining stuff like this. So like whenever you mouse over an ally, as her, it will pop up saying, try pressing E, and it'll go boom, and you fire a shield at them, and it's cool. Aww. And then her, her ultimate, which, everything else is on a cooldown. Ultimates are charged by taking or dealing or healing damage. So ultimates sort of charge a variable rate based on participation. And there's no leveling, I should stress. It's got a lot of MOBA to it, but there's no leveling or items or gold or experience or anything like that.
Huh.
Which is important. And her ultimate is she creates this kind of like massive singularity with her gun that pulls every player in a radius around it, to it, a bit like the black hole in Dota, if anyone knows what that it does, and then sort of traps them there, taking damage in a sort of central point for a while. And so the first game I played was basically Payload from TF2, with a slight difference in that all the maps I played were like capture point, attack, defend. So a team of defenders attempting to defend a series of capture points that are captured one by one as the attackers move forward. Against the time limit, the attackers get the time back if they manage to capture one of the points. One of them was straightforward, like point, 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 end. This one is like the first point is a static capture point, but it's the vehicle that they will then have to escort to the end of the map to win. And in that map, I was defending, and sort of roughly getting the hang of it. Partly it's strange because you're playing with people who've never played it before, but there's a sort of natural back and forth, and you start to see how your abilities need to sync up with other people's abilities to be immediately impactful. But because it's not a leveling game or experience game like a MOBA, you are as capable of killing people as you are as at shooting the gun at them. And as the big heavy tank character, I was a bit more static than I might otherwise like to have been. But, you know, I'm there sort of shielding allies and lobbing grenades around corners to try and, like, flush people out. And then I had a moment where it clicked, where I got my super for the first time. Sorry, my ult. And just as it happened, another character who was playing an archer called Hanzo, who has an arrow he can fire into a wall. When it sticks into a wall, it emits like a sonar pulse that reveals enemies through walls for everyone on his team, showed me that basically the entire enemy team was about to run through a doorway to try and flank in the same direction. So I fired my massive black hole into that doorway and got four of them and another team of six. And it's this amazing feeling of like having pulled them all together. And I was sort of like gleefully just lobbing grenades into the center of this thing, got a quadra kill, which is presented like an MMO style kind of like quadra kill kind of thing. And it was a huge moment, and I could hear because we were the first people in the beginning of the day for the press preview, I could hear the developers like go, "Hey!" And it was like, and one of them went, "That guy likes it now." And he was completely right. Yeah. And because it was like, that was the moment where I was like, "Oh, fuck." Right. Cause initially I felt a bit passive. Like I'm the big slow tank that puts shields on people and doesn't die. Whereas you got snipers and other characters doing things. But that was the moment where I was like, "Fuck all of you." And then at the end of that game, one thing it does, they're actually expanding this, I spoke to them about it, but this was an earlier build. One thing it does at the end of the game, or I guess at the end of a round, because you play as attackers, then you play as defenders, or the other way around. At the end of the round, it goes like, play of the match, and it picks something out, and then plays it to every person in the game as like a replay section. So it like flashes up your name and your character. So it's like, play of the match, and I got it for that quadra kill in the first game. Mm. This is not the only reason I like Overwatch. the first game I had, it was like, play of the match, Chris. And then like me like blowing up four people, which was fucking rad.
I played it last BlizzCon in an earlier form. And, for exactly the same reason I came to love it, because I was the Hanzo, who's the archer, and he's got like a bouncing arrow that is basically a shotgun. If you fire it into an enclosed space, it will kill a lot of people in that space.
It splits and ricochets.
It's fucking really satisfying to use. But he's also, his super is, he sends three kind of spiritual spiraling dragons firing across the map. You just hear him scream, and then all, you know the dragons are coming, and that, you know, you've got to get out of the way. Killed like four people just fortunately with that, and that became the play of the match, and that was like Chris, the moment where I went,
yeah, I'm into this now.
Yep, I don't want to do that. This is actually the time.
One thing I miss from being press is that the first time you play a game is often with other press who have also never played it before. Don't get that in the wild. Anytime you buy a game as a customer, everyone you're playing against seems like 10 times more experienced than you, and you just get your ass kicked. I remember like the first time I played Modern Warfare multiplayer, I was reviewing it, so it was against press who's also never played it before, and I did really well, and I was like, killing everyone with a knife and stuff, and it was the best game of Call of Duty multiplayer I've ever had. Never had that high since.
It's so good playing against mainstream press as well.
Yeah, they're all idiots.
My time with Titanfall for review was split between an early event that EA did and then playing it in the wild. And like, I walked out of that EA event going like, I'm going to be a pro Titanfall. Because I played it for 2.5 days solid and just ruined every single game. And because I played some FPSs, whereas like the person sitting next to me was like, so this is a video game, eh? Looks fun. Like, no, it isn't.
This is real, damn it.
But yeah, so that that sort of win was the thing that sparked my interest in it. But like, actually, then I kind of picked apart what is a really, really well-designed team strategy game. And the thing that I've come away from feeling now, that I can now feel, is that TF2 is a mess. Now it is a mess. Mm. Like, it was beautiful once. But like, I went back to TF2 relatively recently. I think I spoke about it on the podcast. And it was just a sort of fucking crazy shit show.
What's going on in there anymore.
And it's a wonderful game, TF2. And like, Team Fortress will always mean a huge amount to me. But I can see my, like, if this game had been in TFC's place when I was playing that, I can imagine being in love with this more in a way. Because of the way it's very clear about what every character can do, but it provides opportunities to excel through your different abilities that feel genuinely different and gives you access to a lot of the fantasies of playing TF2 at a high level, really quickly. Like, I mean, that's a clear way of putting it. But like, for example, there's a character called Tracer. She's all over the art for the game. She's like the Cockney one with the terrible accent.
Yeah.
Blizzard just really needs to stop paying American actors to be English or Scottish because it doesn't fucking work. But anyway, initially I looked at her skill set and was like, how the fuck is she in the same game as some of these other characters? Cause she seems really underwhelming. So she's in like the soldier category, which is like the damage dealing stuff. And there in her category is like an amazing character who can fly, has a rocket launcher, and whose ult basically like opens her like Gundam robot suit out, and she like stands in the air like haloed by rockets, and then like bombards an entire area and can wipe out an entire team.
Yeah, I want to play her.
Everyone wants to play her. She's in the same category as Tracer, who
she has two guns.
She has two guns, but so, they do a lot of damage very, very close. But she can't take a hit. Like, she's one shot killed by the rocket launcher.
Wow.
She can't take a hit. Her Uzis, do a lot of damage up close, but they have to be reloaded constantly because he's like, and you're done. And her abilities, none of them are damaging except her ult. And her ult at first is just a sticky grenade. Like, the kind of thing you'd expect to have in at your disposal fairly regularly. It's a grenade that you can stick on the wall or on a player. That is lethal to the person you stick it on, but is otherwise regular grenade radius. It's not like a nuke or anything. And that's her ult. Mm. And her other abilities are, she can, blink, like teleport. So she can, but it's laterally. So it's in the direction you're currently moving laterally, but if you jump, you don't go up kind of thing. She can like store up to three charges of it. So blink, 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 and they recharge quite quickly. And her other ability rewinds her through time about 4 seconds. And resets her to the health and ammo that she was at that time.
Presumably you can't use that after you've been one shot killed by the rocket launcher.
No, you can't use it if you died. It's not like, it's not like a braid style kind of get out of a thing. But if you get like pegged once by a sniper and the next shot will kill you, you can then rewind time and not have taken that shot.
Huh.
But those are both quite passive things. And given that she's really aggressive, really close range and doesn't have any health, you're like, why do you do this? And the first time I played her terribly. And then I realized that basically she's this game's version of the spy. And it's not that obvious. Like, there's another character who can flank quite well. But Overwatch it's actually not about the capture points. It's about these choke points that form between the capture points. Because defending on the capture points is really risky for the defenders. Because if you get wiped and you're all respawning, the attackers will just get you at that point. Because they have no more distance left to cover. The defenders are incentivized to set up what their choke points as turrets and stuff like that. You can build as certain characters, that kind of thing. Set up their choke points, or at least the line of battle, at natural points in the map that have always been designed for that purpose. Multiple levels and elevations and flanking routes, but broadly speaking, somewhere on the map there'll be an entrenched fight between the heavy frontliners on each team. And then Tracer's job is to quickly teleport through that line of battle, which he can do, pick at people, and then rewind back and do it again in a different direction.
Huh.
And so and you have this thing, it's like, I've never done it in a shooter before, where you're almost playing out different versions of the same attempt on the same emplacement. You run in and you kind of spray somebody with the guns, and maybe you kill them, maybe you don't, and then you see them see you, and you're not supposed to rewind when you're already being shot at. You're supposed to rewind the moment they catch you, like a stealth game. It's like, oh, bye, and then you, and you're back again. And you do that, and sometimes you get the kills, sometimes you can spend longer behind enemy lines if you're doing well. You learn where the health packs that spawn are, so that you're stealing their health packs from behind them, teleporting between them. And so, like, you know, I did something where I got, I was really low, and the health pack hadn't spawned yet, but I stood in the health pack, ran out to try and find another one, didn't find it, but was getting shot at, and then rewinded myself to the other health pack, which had then spawned, got my health back, and then went out again.
Is it like a flexible thing where you decide how long to rewind for?
I think it's as long as you hold it down, but right. I think every time I always ended up rewinding the maximum amount anyway, just to kind of like get myself the furthest right. from danger. And at that point, her ult, which initially seems very underwhelming, becomes fucking amazing because it's her only like reliably lethal, unescapable thing.
Right, she's like a backstab, basically, isn't it?
It's like, but you have these amazing, like, so I had this brilliant moment, which is, again, it didn't get in play as a player of the day or whatever, but it was for me, like, the coolest thing I did in that game was having been sort of harassing from the enemy lines for a long time. And actually, all I was really trying to do is get them to turn around, because the moment they turn around to chase you, your team, the attackers, have a huge amount of opportunity to break their line because they're not looking in the right direction anymore.
That's definitely true of the spy. Like, half the damage you do is just from people you never attack.
Look over here! But there was a moment where I'd got my soup and I went back in, and they were entrenched, and they were, I think almost at that point, deciding to ignore me because they were like, they knew that Trace was going to be around somewhere. So I did like this triple blink right on top of them, stuck a grenade to the back of their medic, and then rewound. And I didn't see it, but I just hear the explosion, and then it's like quadra kill. And it's because it's gone off, and they've been grouped together, because that's how the medics are encouraged to work. It's like, you know, cuddling each other for the health. And they hadn't noticed. Because it doesn't give you like an indicator, I think, when a bomb's been stuck on you. It's just this moment. But they will see it in there, because whenever you die, you see your death played out from the eyes of the person who killed you. So what they will have then all seen is this kind of tracer girl, like beep, 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 and then beep. And then there's such a cool thing, but also a really, really nice, like concise idea of how the game should be played, put into one character.
You might have actually already said this in your preamble. I missed it, but can you? How does the team selection work? Do you have symmetrical teams?
So you can, and actually, I asked them about this, and the game is designed such that they expect players to change character mid game, and you can do that whenever you want.
Oh.
Whenever you die, you can change your character. You lose your progress towards your ult, which is the main reason you wouldn't. But they anticipate that if a competitive meta develops for the game, it will develop around the idea that you have one character and one ult for one section of a match, and then you switch or you mix the composition up. And this is actually how TF2...
Do you have to select the two that you're going to play in advance?
No.
Okay.
And you can have multiples of the same character on the same team. So if you want to all be Tracer, you can all be Tracer.
It's the same as TF2.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. This is how the TF2 meta worked.
Yeah.
And this is when I asked them, like, you know, do you see that being the case? Or would you lock it down for competitive play and have a MOBA-style system where you draft a lineup at the beginning of the game and said, no, we want it to be about switching. And are they implied because of that, that you won't buy characters? Because for that to work, everyone needs access to lots of different characters.
Hmm.
That's a different question. I actually don't know if it's going to be free-to-play, which I was assuming it would, but... We'll see, I suppose. But the thing that I think is the key thing, because that really opens it up, because then it goes from being a game which could get really slow. Like if you were locked into one character and you have this really simple vocabulary of I teleport, rewind, and put bombs on things, and you just do that for an entire game, it risks feeling boring, or if it's not appropriate to the defensive or offensive scenario you're in, it risks, oh, I fucked this by picking Tracer as a defender and I can't do anything.
Hmm.
Whereas actually you always have that freedom to move sideways in the roster and just try something else. And each of these characters kind of boils down to this kind of cool little cycle of fun actions, each with their own they all see the map very differently because of what their opportunities are. Hmm. And it's just...
There are even different traversal methods for different characters. So, for example, some characters will be able to mount and do a few parkour moves to dart up walls that other characters won't be able to do. And there are some just characters that can just straight up kind of fly, in some instances, and other characters that are just based on the ground, but very fast. Like and you consider TF2, which has 9 incredibly well balanced, classes. Every character in Overwatch is a class. They behave, they have roles, but they feel very different. Their abilities are completely different.
Probably
a dozen.
It's closer to 20, I think. There were two they've announced that weren't playable in the build I played, but a lot were. And Tom's right. Like, what's really interesting is it has roles and it's 4. It's like soldier, defender, tank, and healer.
Hmm.
It's actually a brilliant thing on the character select screen, because there isn't a limit on how many different each class you can do. It doesn't just say your team doesn't have any spies or your team doesn't have any medics. It abstracts it and says your team doesn't have any long range damage. Your team doesn't have any. can't take very much damage. Your team doesn't have any single specific healing, like, you know, that kind of thing. And that's And that's used to help you make a choice. It's not saying pick this character or pick this class. It's like solve this problem.
That's really smart.
Like your team doesn't have any flanking potential. And when you die, it pops up a tooltip that's specific to both what killed you and what character you are. So, you know, I was killed by, Farah, who's the flying jetpack rocket lady, her rockets as Tracer. And it's like, it basically said, you should really be able to dodge that as Tracer. You're very, very fast. Stop running around like an
idiot.
You're
very, very bad.
It didn't. There's a character called Winston who's like this giant ape in armor, who, can leap and has an electric gun. And, his leap, I managed to leap directly into the sea as him the first time I charged out of the,
doorway. You should be able to defeat the sea.
Yeah. And it didn't have a pop-up for don't jump. Just don't throw a monkey in the ocean. But yeah, the other thing the last thing I want to say in praise of it, and I'm really excited about it now. Like, it's, you know, I don't know when it's coming to open beta, but it's now like one of my most anticipated games because I can see myself pumping so much time into it. With the caveat that it'll need really good matchmaking, but every shooter does, so whatever. Is that while I wasn't sold on the art style from the cinematic trailer they put out, in motion, it's beautiful. Like, it's really nice. Oh. And the lighting, it feels like Blizzard quality kind of shine on everything, but genuinely new as well. Like, it has that polish. The other thing is they have completely aced, well, they've definitely improved their game when it comes to designing female characters. Like, in a big, big way. Mm. Like, it feels like they took a lot to heart with the criticism that, you know, latter day WoW and StarCraft and stuff have received, and even Hearthstone with its, you know, many weirdly, you know, bum and boob heavy cards. And, yeah, it's a very balanced selection of characters, balanced selection of body types. Like, the game does have, Widowmaker, who's like a sexy purple French assassin with a not very, in like a skin tight costume, and a character called Sinestra, who's one of the, supports, who's like an Indian lady wearing this sort of like split ball gown. But it's at least that's a little bit unusual compared to how, you know, women are usually exposed in games. But it also has Zarya, who's just huge and muscular, and she's the heavy, basically. She's the TF2 heavy. It has, Tracer, who looks fast, like, you know, she's wearing skin tight clothing, but she's designed to look like she's incredibly quick, and she is. And then Farah, who's like basically the biggest badass in it, as far as I can tell. She looks like Samus from Metroid, but in this kind of like Egyptian Horus themed Gundam suit.
Oh, wow.
With like this kind of like fold down like hawk beak visor above her head. And it's like, yeah. It's like, and that's, you know, cool. There's nothing, you know, sort of sexualized about her presentation at all, really. She's just really scary. And, That's great. Like, that's really positive. I mean, it would be great if they could apply some of that to, like, fucking the Succubus Kerrigan skin. Which is, you know, weird that it's the same company, but it's nice to see them design it. I mean, and this is obviously before they announced the series of, like, fucking, like, Santa's Little Helper skins for all the female characters when Christmas comes around. But that implicit, like, you know, pending sigh notwithstanding, like, I was just dead impressed by how it looked. It's really good.
I want to play it. When's it gonna go beta-y?
They haven't said.
It's been in the Battle.net client for ages as a kind of zone.
Like, I assumed it. That meant it was coming imminently.
Yeah, me too. So. It's been in there for a while now, so.
What have you been playing, Tom Francis?
I have been watching someone play Soma. I played Soma for a while, and then I stopped playing Soma and decided to watch someone play Soma instead. Yeah, I played it. So last time I was on the podcast 2 weeks ago, and I played it when I came back from the podcast, somewhat drunk. And it turns out that's the worst way to play a horror game, because you're not very scared of things when you're drunk. In fact, some might say you're overconfident.
Is this the game by Frictional?
Yes. Right. So the makers of Amnesia, and they didn't make Machine for Pigs, but while that was being made, they were making this. It's similar kind of format of game, but it's set in an underwater base, and it's less of a horror game. They call it psychological horror, and the themes are meant to be scary. But they said on their blog recently that, like, a lot of people complain that the game is not scary enough, and they feel that's sort of an expectation set by their previous game, but not necessarily by what this game is trying to be. It's not meant to be a straight out horror game. But that's, so one of the reasons I decided not to play it, was that I got to the first scary bit where there's a monster sort of stalking you, and as I say, I wasn't playing under the best circumstances because I was drunk, And also just in general, I'm a very curious player, and my main instinct in all games is to find out what I can and can't do and find out what the boundaries of simulation are. And if there's some weird, mysterious thing, I want to go over and look at it. So the weird, mysterious thing stomped in all the music and all the lighting and even like screen effects telling you, oh my God, terrifying thing, don't even look at it. So I ran straight up to it, looked it in the face, and that's just a weird machine thing. And then it like nudged me, and that made me limp for a while, and then it nudged me again, and then I had to restart. And so
games.
It wasn't really scary, and okay, if they weren't going for like pure horror, then that's not a fatal flaw, but then it's used as a horror thing. Because if you're not scared of it, it's just fucking boring. You just got to sit there and wait for it to go away, and it just sits outside. You know, Alien Isolation, I think, really is scary. And even in that game, I got super bored of just sitting in the cupboard waiting for the fucking thing to go away. And this is like that without the fear. And so I ended up watching someone play it, and it's a YouTuber called Christopher Odd. And watching him play is amazing because he's everything I am not. He's like the dream player for developers because he just engages with it so much. Just from the word go, reads every bit of text. He's fascinated by it. Every time there's a date stamp on it, he says, oh, so this is like 2 weeks after the last lock. I'm like, what? You can just put that together? You're actually paying attention? And when there's a surprise, he's like, what? And like, he's just really emotionally in tune with it. And actually, I think I like that as an audience because I'm not only... am I not going to get that from like a no commentary playthrough, but also I'm not even going to get it from the game. Like even when I'm playing, I'm not that engaged. I'm more engaged with his playthrough than I was with mine. And one of the things that's really interesting about it, Soma is based on the central kind of, question about it is very closely related to what I did my thesis on, at university, which is the question of if you teleport someone by, replicating them exactly and then destroying the original, is that murder or is it just transportation? And they delve very much into like a central faction of the game and a source of friction and conflict is a bunch of people who believe that it's only transportation if the original dies at the same moment or shortly after. And that's weird. I don't know why they think shortly after is okay. I don't think shortly after is okay. I think it has to be instantaneous or nothing, or it doesn't make sense. And I'm not sure it makes sense anyway. But anyway, it deals with very themes I'm absolutely fascinated by. And even better, it doesn't. It's not sort of like preachy about them. It doesn't come down and say, this is the real truth of this thing. It just investigates it and says, some people believe this and some people believe that. And here's a dramatic situation in which that would be a real conflict where people would have to really decide, like, this is not theoretical anymore. We have to figure out if this is death or not because it actually matters. And it kind of takes the form. It's not actually really about teleportation. It's about putting a human consciousness in a robot and various forms of that. There's all kinds of different levels of that going on. But it involves robots who believe they're human. And that is a little bit, creepy, I think. Like the first time you find a robot who believes it's human, the way he's talking and what he's saying and stuff is much more creepy than any of the kind of monster stomping around bits. And the thing that was really interesting about this guy's playthrough is there's a bit where you have, I'm not going to spoil any specifics, but, there's, a robot that's been helping you and a robot and one robot that's just mad. It's just wandering around just barking nonsense. And you have to shut a robot down in a way that is very much presented as death. And you get to choose which one. And he basically kills the helpful one. And the comments are just full of, like, just shock. Because he doesn't do it as like a, lol, look what I can do. He's just seriously considers the situation, then kills the helpful one. And everyone is just like, what the hell are you doing, man? You're insane. How could you do that? And... again, I don't want to spoil any specifics, but he explains himself in the comments. And after reading his explanation, I realized, shit, he's actually right. He had a very good reason for doing that. And we don't know for sure the facts of the situation, but basically, based on what he saw, it probably was the ethical thing to do.
Weird.
And so it's impressive that the game can actually involve situations complicated enough that, you know, my instinct and almost everyone's instinct is kind of wrong. I still think I would have done the other thing. But it's... If you take it as seriously as he is, and he's really thinking about the themes and the what the implications are of a robot acting like a human and whether that counts as a real person or not, then there are other considerations, and that's really interesting. The thing I actually have been playing is Armello.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. How far do you go with it?
Hang on. This is the same thing I'm thinking of. It's like a strategy kind of board game style thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I played it for one of the articles on Blockpost Shotgun a while ago, but it was quite early, I think. I don't think they'd find everything out. What's it like now?
So it does look like a board game. It's kind of like, it's very nicely rendered fantasy landscape with a big palace in the middle. And the storyline is, oh, everyone's animals. And the storyline is the king, who is a bear, I think?
Lion,
okay. he has the rot, which is like a disease / corruption that is infecting him, and it sent him mad. And so there's a nice little intro tutorial bit where you'll think the king's fine and you're going around trying to serve him, and then he just starts having his guards attack you and just goes mad. And so it's justified that he's got to go. And there's like 4 or 5 heroes. I'm just playing against the AI, and each one is trying to become the next king. But there are multiple different ways of doing it, and it's turn-based, and you get dealt cards that are like special abilities, and they cost certain resources to play, and they give you things like, some of them are just like spells that buff you. One of them is like, I think it's called spies, and you can just send spies to attack an enemy player, and you can play it even during their turn, and it'll just take 1 health off them. So it's not that great as like a combat thing. But if you just watch someone else play and they take a bunch of damage, and then you realize, oh, that guy's probably on 1 health now, and just play it then, you can just kill them like that. But the ways you can take over the kingdom are, the king is dying of rot, and he has a huge amount of health. He's massively tough. He's in a palace surrounded by really tough guards. And if you even enter the palace, even if there are no guards there, you have to face a really difficult peril, which is like a sort of test that you have to throw dice to pass. And he is losing 1 health every day, and a day is 2 turns. And the ways to win are, you can go in the palace and kill the king. If you kill the king in any way, you win, and you are the new king. One of the ways to kill the king is, he's rotten, but you can become more rotten. And if you get infected with the rot, it can happen accidentally, or you can try and do it intentionally. The rot will hurt you for 1 health point every morning. But if you have more rot than another rotten creature, all of their rot becomes extra attack power for you. So they get no advantage and you get a massive advantage. And the king is very rotten. So if you ever got more corrupt than him, it would be simple to take him out in combat. But of course you're losing health all the time. And if you go up to 5 rot, then the stone circles that normally are the only source of healing, kill you instead of healing you. So, those are like the killing ways. The other way is like, you get prestige for just capturing towns and killing other players. And, whoever has the most prestige every day, they get to advise the king on what policy to pass. And the king, there's no doubt that the king is mad. There's no doubt that he is, that he needs to be overthrown. Because every policy he passes is just fucking absurd. Like, well, his policies would be called things like absolute famine. Or just like ravaging hate. All people in all villages are killed by my guards. Or everyone loses 5 health. Stuff like that. And, you get, if you're the prestige leader, if you have the most prestige, then each day he'll ask you which of 2 terrible, terrible things you want to happen. And some of them are just like baffling, because like what, one of the last ones I saw was, prestige leader loses 3 prestige for being a terrible leader, and all guards gain 3 health. And the guards are never on your side exactly. Like, you don't have to fight them unless you have a bounty on your head. But they're never really a good thing. And the only way anyone would ever choose that card is if they are the prestige leader. So the debuff is against the person who's choosing it. So why would you ever choose it?
I guess if the other option was even worse.
Yeah, so that's one thing. The other option in this case was, the king gains 1 health and I gain 1 health. And I guess if I was going to kill him, maybe I might not want that, particularly if I had a lot of health and he didn't have much. But also I realized that buffing up the king's guards, at some point in this game, I became prestige leader. And I realized that buffing the king's guards would actually be good, because I don't want anyone to kill the king until he dies of the rot. And if I buff him, then he gets health that helps against both being killed by enemies and by being killed by the rot. So it's going to last longer.
Thinking if he dies of the rot, you as a prestige leader win.
Yes, so that's the prestige victory, is you become the prestige leader, and then while the king is considers you his trusted advisor, if he dies then presumably, I guess, he's like leaving the kingdom to you intentionally, even though he's fucking mad. But it's really nice. It's like really complicated. There's so many different systems in it, but I found it quite nice to play, except for 2 things which are driving me fucking crazy. And one of them is just how long it takes for everyone else to take their turn. And not for the Civ reason, where it's actually having to do some computation, but because everything's animated, and you can't skip anything, and you can't fast forward, and you just have to watch every animation play out.
Tom Senior has a long-time strategy. Buff is shaking his head there.
Yeah, can't have that. Just can't have it.
So, you see, I searched on Google to see if there was any way of doing this, and I just found loads of people complaining that there's no way to do this. And in response, hardcore fans of the game say, oh, I see someone hasn't figured out that you can play cards on enemy turns. It's true, you can.
Mm.
And if you have some cards that are in any way relevant, then you could spend some time thinking about that. But often, like sometimes during your turn, you'll play most of your cards. How many cards you have depends on a certain stat that some characters are less of and some you might not specialize in. Loads of cards are just bad. They're just like, this costs 3 gold and it does something like boosts your magic stat, but I'm not a magic character. So there's just no point in using it. I just need to get rid of it. And you can't get rid of it at any time. You have to wait for the right opportunity to kind of burn it in certain circumstances.
Hmm.
So often you just have a card where none of these things will ever be relevant on this turn, no matter what anybody does. Even if someone comes up and kills me, it's not relevant. Even if, nothing that could possibly happen would require me to use this card. And sometimes, like the last few turns I played were fairly quick, or comparatively quick. But before that, particularly when I was learning the game, if you don't know the game well enough, then you don't know when you'd play these cards anyway. And early on, stuff like the king passes his like total famine policy, new policy, decided everyone should starve. And that, actually no, it wasn't that one, it was something that put a peril on every town in the kingdom. And it has to move the camera, pan the camera smoothly to each town. And then a banner has to fall from the sky and land in the town to show you that it's got the peril on it. And then it just has to do that for every single town. And that just takes a lot of time. And then every NPC dragon that's roaming the map, all of those are treated just like another player. So it has to zoom the camera over to them. They have to move one square, which doesn't matter at all because they're not going anywhere near anyone. And then it moves on to the next dragon. And at some point there was, like 5 dragons. So I had to do like 5 extra players, basically. And then every player has to tell you what type of cards they each got and which their role, which maybe is useful, but I can't deduce much from it. You don't see what card they got. You just see what category it comes under. At some point it was just taking so long. I was having to like go away and make a cup of tea and come back again and see, oh no, it's still not my turn. I'll just carry on.
The thing about strategy games, especially turn-based strategy games, is that after about 3 hours, you stop engaging with the fantasy and you engage purely with the game logic. It's about your decisions and how they affect the systems. And that once you reach that point, anything that gets in the way artistically, any sort of like, aesthetic flourish becomes meaningless to you. You're just like, actually, I just want to know what the fuck happened based on the decision I just made. And it's kind of, I mean, Civ realized this a long time ago. You can just turn that stuff off in the menu and everything happens very quickly.
I understand why they wouldn't introduce an option in the menus to automatically skip all enemy turns, because that means you would never find out about those opportunities when it is worth spending a card.
Mm.
But just a fast forward button, just while you're holding right trigger or something, it would fast forward through the enemy turn. It would be so useful.
Yeah.
The other thing is even easier to fix, and maybe this one's just me, but when you're in a fight, it's determined by dice rolls, and you have to... There's an opportunity to spend the cards to get bonuses. And so each card has a different icon, and it's essentially like getting a free dice that has that result. So it might be a shield, and that means you get 1 extra point of protection, or a sword and 1 extra point of attack. Really, really important both to get an advantage in tough fights and also just to get rid of those cards, because sometimes the card is shit, but the icon's a really useful one. And to spend those cards, there's a time limit to spend them, which is annoying. And then to spend them, I'm playing on a gamepad, and you have to press... D-pad right, then D-pad up and down to select them, then hold right trigger to say you want that one, and then press A while holding right trigger to play it. All of which, the right trigger and A thing is actually fine, but the biggest problem is that rolling the dice, the control for that is moving the left stick in any way at all. If you touch the left stick at any point, you roll your dice, and you've cancelled all your opportunity to spend those cards.
Why are you playing it with a game plan?
Different times I have died because of that. Because I look at the cards,
come on!
I'm thinking about which card I want, and I think, oh, I want the card near the top, and I push the left stick up, and that rolls your dice, and now you've lost the opportunity to spend not only that card, but any cards at all, and then I die.
Do you have a Steam controller yet, Tom?
No, they've sent it, I think. It's on its way to me.
They've told a lot of people they've sent it, but apparently people have been waiting a few weeks with that.
I would like it, because
they're being distributed on Valve time, apparently, because they're lost in the ether somewhere.
Yeah, that would probably help. Unless like touching the touchpad, automatically rolls the dice.
That'd be worse. Breathe on it.
Just like sticks should move your selection, and you must press a button to confirm it. Just moving a stick to confirm something is a horrible system. Anyway, other than that, it's great. I haven't decided whether those two floors actually ruin it or not, because I've rage quit it about five... I've never finished a game, so I'm trying to finish a game, and I've rage quit this game four times now. Twice from moving a stick, once because it was just not my turn, and it just took so long, I thought, okay, I just have time for this, I've got to do something else in my life. And I think the other time...
That's never a good thing to think while you're playing a game, is it?
I don't know why it's so long.
I like the idea that games are just ways of delaying that inevitable response. So that the fewer barriers they put between you and your next action means that you just simply don't realise that, you know, your life is better.
You'd never have that realisation during a game.
No, that's very
true. You can have it afterwards where you like, look back and go, why?
What happened
to
me?
If you're like midway through and it's like, actually, hang on, then no.
This is a waste
of time. I was going to give up on it forever after that time when I quit because it was taking so long, and then I decided I'd come back to it with an audiobook on my phone so that I could listen to a book while it's playing.
Hmm.
Tom Senior, you've been playing the most exciting game of all, I think, probably this week.
Yeah, Deus Ex Mankind Divided.
Yeah!
What?
OMGs.
You actually played it?
I did. I played it for like 4 or 5 hours. And actually, a very small segment of it for 4 or 5 hours. It's just one corner of one hub. And yet it sustained me easily for 4 or 5 hours because it's a Deus Ex game and you can just fuck with it endlessly, it seems. Anyone who's played Human Revolution will be pleased to learn that it's a lot like Human Revolution in almost every way, except the most bullshit things about Human Revolution are now not bullshit.
Hooray!
Hooray!
Hey.
So you don't have to eat chocolate bars all the time?
You don't have to eat chocolate bars
all
the
time. Oh,
my God. They've got
was the hub you played, was that Prague?
Was Prague, yeah.
I was there.
Yeah, you were there in real life while I was playing at the Deus Ex.
Are we double-Pragued?
Maybe we infiltrated the same theatres or something.
We'll have to compare notes.
The video we've seen from like E3 was in Prague, right? And it had a long intro section that looked like it could be a bit annoying because it was all talking and presumably not a cutscene.
Yeah, this demo took place. There was almost no kind of narrative context for the demo.
Okay.
In fact, there were no conversations for most of it. We played two bits. There was a Dubai bit, which felt like a fairly complete tutorial level. But the main thing, the actual sandbox bit was set in a theater in Prague at night while it was raining, and there were robots stalking the rainy streets, and there were the snipers on the rooftops. It's like, get into that theater then, which is ruled by gangs for some reason, but it's just an excuse for you to go to a nice place.
Amgram gangs.
These ones are Shakespeareites and these ones are stoppardists.
It's just like, go nuts, just go in there, do whatever you want. And I did go nuts. the energy thing, that's probably for people who played the previous game, that's the big thing that was the worst thing. It's like, you've got two pips of energy, you punch a man, and that's it. You've got one pip of energy,
you punch another man,
and that's it. That's it. You're not a Superman anymore. You're just kind of a lame stealth hero in a nice coat. So the new energy system is far, far more generous. Every time you activate an ability or an augmentation, it will dock you a chunk of your energy bar. If it's a continuous ability like Cloak, it will continue to gradually deplenish. But then, once you've stopped being cloaked, it replenishes again, back up to the point that has been deleted, that has kind of been...
it's like a segmented bar, is it?
No, it's not. It looks continuous, but functionally it is segmented. Like, whenever you activate an ability, the activation cost decreases the overall size of the bar by a chunk.
I see. So the activation cost is permanent, but the duration cost is
replenishing. Right. Yeah. Which the rhythm works really, really well. And of course you can use, I think it's called a biocell or something. You just eat one to replenish your mana bar back to full, or electricity bar, whatever it is.
And what does punching cost?
Punching, it costs a little bit of energy, but you could punch a lot of people. A lot of people. And the best thing about this, actually, is that you can actually chain abilities together in creative ways, which you just couldn't really do in Human Revolution. You had to pick one ability, like, I want to cloak. And that was it for the entire level, pretty much, unless you had some chocolate bars on you. Whereas now, there's a brilliant new dash move, which is basically Blink from Dishonored, but with cool golden electricity.
Sweet.
And
is that stealthy?
It's the fact that it's
a golden flash of electricity.
Yes, but that you can, the way you can combine orgs actually can make it more stealthy than it initially appears, which is one of the interesting things about this compared to Human Revolution. So the dash move is like Blink, but depending on what it hits, the context, contextually it will react differently. So if the dash hits a piece of cover, you'll just take cover. If you can aim it upwards and there's a kind of ledge there, you'll mantle it. If it hits a guard, you will punch the fuck out of them, with a really amazing sound as well. The sound effects for this stuff are really, really satisfying.
Are you actually teleporting?
It's unclear. You're not actually teleporting. You're kind of, it's like almost like a Dragon Ball Z thing where you're just surrounded by so much electricity and you just kind of propel yourself forward at amazing speed. I don't understand how it's supposed to really work, but at the same time, there's a thing called Titan Armor where you become a giant black triangle monster and deflect bullets. So it's kind of gradually stretching what, you know, you'd expect an augmented human to be able to do. But the cool thing is that you can, once you've dashed in Human Revolution, that would be it for ages, but actually you've got loads of energy left. So you can dash into the middle of a group of guards and then Typhoon, which is a move from Human Revolution where you spin and just shed like dandruff warheads from your shoulders, which then explodes and kills everyone. So you can combine those two. Or you can activate Silent Feet, or Quiet Happy Feet, at the same time as dash, and you'll do a completely silent dash, which will let you kind of go up and snap someone's neck or horribly stab them. And yes, and a lot of the kind of creativity in combat scenarios is almost about like, it's more like solid, it's like improvised mid-combat creativity that you couldn't do at all in Human Revolution, which makes it a much more kind of moment-to-moment, more interesting moment-to-moment action game, for sure. Does have new augmentations, but not only that, he has different versions of each augmentation to suit your playstyle, which is a big change from Human Revolution as well, where if you wanted to be non-lethal, you could never use the Typhoon bombs because they're bombs. But now there's a non-lethal variant where instead of warheads, you release gas grenades, which pop into green gas. And there's a different thing you have to deal with after that, because they spasm and fire kind of around themselves randomly as they're passing out.
Stealth.
So it's a risk. It's not a stealthy move by any means, but it is non-lethal. So
ish. Can they shoot each other?
No, I didn't see that happen, but that doesn't mean it didn't. I mean, it's chaos in there.
That would suck if you're going for the non-lethal protection, they all just shoot each other while somebody
effectively. Well, I mean, you shouldn't use the spasm grenade.
Spasm dandruff.
Yeah.
Spasm dandruff. And yeah, so he can also, you know, he's got his big, elbow chisels that kashing out of his arms and kill people horribly.
And you can shoot them now?
You can shoot them now. And I've tried to pin guys to walls. I know you can, because in the trailer, yeah, I've seen it happen. I tried it a lot and couldn't make it happen, but I'm sure it'll be in.
Do you have to retrieve them, or do they come back on their own?
I think you nano-generate them inside your arms somehow.
Okay.
Nano-generate my fist chisels.
You can charge them as well to make them explosive. And like as you do that, the surface of the nanoblade kind of ripples in a slightly disturbing way, and the end of it glows like almost white hot, and then you let it go. And
what's the non-lethal variant of the chisel?
Well, the non-lethal variant of that is you shoot a wall as a distraction, and then they go over there. But which seems like there's so much stuff to pick up in this game. Like one of the big differences with the new engine they've got is that they can just put loads of detritus and just crap all over the place. So you're never, you know. In Prague, I was never more than like 2 meters away from a traffic cone or something.
That's what they say about Prague.
Throw at the enemies in some way. But if you want to do it in a really cool way with your own custom generated bespoke nano chisel, then you can create that distraction that way.
Artisanal nano chisel.
Isn't there like a taser thing that's the same?
Oh God, the taser thing's fucking great. The taser thing is, I got so excited playing this because all the toys are so much fun. Your knuckles can turn into individual taser guns on your right hand.
Taser knuckles, right?
So you hold down the button and you kind of scan it across enemies, and it will form like red target boxes across them. And I think you can go up to 4, given the number of knuckles you have. And
unconfirmed at this stage, but
can you grow extra knuckles for additional target?
Oh, that would be amazing.
Like knuckles all up his arms, pop torso.
He really didn't ask for that.
Yeah.
Could we have made it something other than knuckles? No.
When you actually launch that ability, you get this. They all ping out like, in arcs and hit their targets, and they spasm again for a few moments before collapsing dead. But you can also hit security cameras with the same homing blast, so you could just go up and nuke like 2 guards next to a camera and then just sail on through. I mean, it's more like Dishonored in that you are really quite powerful in a way that it is kind of trivial once you actually understand how the abilities work. But that doesn't mean it's not amazing fun.
Do you know how they'll balance that? What kind of threat could you come up against which would actually challenge you then?
Well, I was killed a few times. You are quite fragile. Like, if you take a few shots, then you have to deal with that either by activating armor or cloaking or, you know, being careful. There are robots now. I think there were in the first game. Yeah. Actually, there were, of course. But they're a bit more like Deus Ex, the original Deus Ex's bipedal robots, so they'll stop around the streets. And conventional weapons, it'll take a long time to take them down, so you're going to need to actually kind of plan for those guys in a very different way. So I lured one down into public toilet, and as I was running into the public toilet, I planted an EMP landmine, sparked, collapsed into against the gents like a drunken mess, like the robot had had a big night out in Prague, and just kind of hadn't quite made it home. I left him in there juddering again, lots of spasming in this game, and carried on about my way. So you can also lift up your weapons and change ammo types and add bits and take, it's Crisis 2 or whatever they added that system basically. Mm. And you can add armor piercing ammo, which will deal with robots better. But, you know, they seem to have different kind of scale of challenge. The thing is, because they were all just like, fleshy gangsters who are very easily killed by a man who's mostly made of electric knuckles and nano blades and stuff. Like they didn't stand much of a chance really, which I think was the point. But,
did you get the sense that for the purpose of a press demo, they were kind of lowballing it a little bit so that people weren't alienated by it? Because Deus Ex is the kind of game that could be, right?
Yeah, sure. I'm not sure that's actually the case. I mean, my big worry for it is polish, to be honest. Like the AI did have some bugs. You always expect bugs, but, I climbed onto the roof, killed the sniper, and then just see what would happen, threw the sniper's dead body down into the street where all the guards were. And they didn't really react to it. In a way that you would definitely expect them to react to that, because it's quite horrendous, really. And yeah, so just AI stuff. I stole that guy's rifle in another playthrough, and then kind of dropped down to the street level and decided I would just snipe everyone in the lobby from the outside and then just waltz through to the target. And yeah, just like pick them off one after the other. And there was no, like, it didn't look like the other guys inside were panicking that much.
Maybe they just didn't want to break character as Amdram. As the Amdram
well
gang.
Trained. Yeah, they were really well trained. Stuff like that. And also the normal polish stuff like frame rate and other things. But like the building blocks in place there are just really exciting. It could be a really great Deus Ex game.
Oh, man. I want to play it.
Have you played Phantom Pain, right?
Yes.
One of our worries was like Phantom Pain might spoil the next Deus Ex for us.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. And they're so different because Phantom Pain is about like square kilometers of space.
Yeah, true.
And then quite like not very detailed structures.
Yeah, whereas you don't go into
Deus Ex, especially Mankind Divided now, like it's the density of kind of geometry is so huge that like there are so many different ways into a relatively small theater that you can do a lot more in a much smaller space, it feels like. And it feels like a more realistic space as well. Like most of the outposts in MGS are really fun to tackle. But when you go in there, there's no furniture or there's no stuff around.
No traffic cones at all.
There's no traffic cones.
Not enough marrows. Really. Stacks and stacks of
barely
marrows.
Barely a cheese wheel.
You can't, it doesn't matter how much you want to, you can't, you know, you just can't chisel a melon.
Yeah. You're chiseling my melon, man.
Sorry, bro.
But everywhere you go in Deus Ex, it's like it looks so detailed, and there are so many ways into that building. I counted like I found 6 or 7 ways, one of which involved carrying an enormous box onto a ledge and then stacking boxes in true Deus Ex style. Excellent. To get to a rooftop, which then had an air vent. Of course, it had a ventilation shaft, which you could had to disable a camera, get in there, and then there's a huge drop on the side of the air vent. And as you drop, you now automatically activate your Icarus landing, which is one of my favorite abilities in video games ever, where he just turns gold and this gentle cushioning, electricity just softens his blow.
Landing.
Is it still as ostentatious as it used to be, the Icarus landing?
Oh yeah. It's a little bit better. It's a little bit quicker because he really milked it in the
Look at me. My legs aren't breaking.
Look how graceful. Master of
stuff. They'd love that. The theatre gangsters would love that.
Yeah. Yeah. Entrance. Yeah. I respect that.
Maybe that's why.
Entering like Billy Ray Cyrus. Two ropes and a big glittery waistcoat.
In fact, the start of the Dubai level involves Jensen just jumping out of a plane, and he just kind of hurtles down. It's a big hero moment, and he gets that fucking rad Deus Ex soundtrack kind of kicks in.
Oh, yeah.
And then at the end, he just Icarus lands, and I was like, fucking yes.
So you have that automatically?
In the demo, I did. I'm not they're not They haven't finalised like precisely how all the kind of.
Presumably, if it's in a cutscene, though, he would have to.
Yeah, that would make sense. I had a feeling it was kind of a default.
Presumably they want to not just reset you to where you were.
Yeah, I definitely had that feeling.
Does the dash and stuff like that give you other traversal options, or is it very much the whole find the vent sort of sequence of stealth?
Dash does give you a way to get up to ledges that you might not otherwise have, but I didn't find a ledge I couldn't find another way up to, but it was a very small area. So,
but how reliant is it on vents, I suppose, is what I'm asking.
There are some vents, man. There are some vents.
Of the six routes in, how many of them are vents?
There was only one main vent way in. But once in there, vents were kind of important if you wanted to get
sure,
around.
Once you're in a vent, the vent becomes very important.
there are the secondary network of vents that became pretty essential to reaching the
Do you still get an exploration bonus for each route that you discover, such that once you've already got your objective, it's still worth going back and going through the vents backwards?
I believe so, actually. Yeah, it does reward you for exploring with their little XP things. But,
as Caesar once said,
that was a fun thing.
Venti VD.
Nice.
Isn't venti like large?
Large.
Yeah, I saw.
It's a kind of coffee.
Yeah, that's grande. Yeah, but I was thinking about coffee.
I came, I got a large coffee, and then I conquered.
Yeah. Is there anything anyone wants to know about Deus Ex Mankind?
How nice is the trench coat?
I didn't see him wear a trench coat. What? He was in military.
Oh yeah, he's got his field. His field.
Field vest.
Yeah, which is take off your trench coat.
Yeah. Well, I'll just do it in a trench coat.
I have to make my peace with that.
Yeah.
You mentioned that it's like Human Revolution, but they fixed all the bullshit. What are the bullshit things?
So all the boss fights, they didn't outsource all the boss fights to some other random company for a start.
Did you get to do one of those?
No, but they said they didn't. And, and the one they actually designed in The Missing Link was
great.
So, you know, that's promising. The, what are the bullshit elements?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying.
It was a good game. I liked that game a lot. So you know,
how many emails did you read?
I read 6 or 7 emails.
Okay,
but they do have more ways of giving you story than just hacking terminals now. So for example, I climbed in through a window and sat next to a laser grid in the middle of a load of guards watching a TV report, and it was a full like TV report from the TV presenter from Human Revolution.
Oh yeah,
and if you play that, you'll know stuff about who she is. That kind of is nice to, it gives you a nice payback for playing the first game and watching your news reports. And that also gives you a load of world flavour.
Is the hacking minigame the same?
The hacking minigame with the nodes is the same.
It looks way nicer.
Because I really liked that.
It looks a lot, it works.
It was good, yeah.
Works exactly the same. It looks way nicer. Instead of the nodes being just flat triangles, or diamonds or whatever they were, they're now like beautiful rotating glowing sphere things. But functionally it's identical. Though, you can now hack on the fly. At range, so you can hack a camera by making a claw with your left hand and then kind of menacing it and twisting your hand at the device. And this will set off a different minigame.
I tried that, getting this audio equipment working, it didn't help.
It looks like he's using the force. It's quite strange, but I like it. And
the minigame is exactly the same as Bioshock 2's, right? Bioshock 2 hacking darts, you fired the hacking dart in and then like a little needle went past a dial and you had to...
Yes, that's right.
Like every golf game ever.
Yeah.
It's the golf mini game.
Mario Golf.
Exactly. That lets you quickly turn off cameras and quickly temporarily disable robots and stuff like that if you choose to get those.
We're menacing them with your claw.
Go to sleep, robot.
So you said you didn't do any conversational stuff?
No, really? There was no conversational stuff in that demo. Mm.
Did they talk about that at all? Whether it's changed? Have they changed the conversation kind of game system that you've got?
Well, it's going to be, based on videos they've released, it's going to be more of a Mass Effect wheel system. And they will bring back the kind of nano conversational stuff, you know, where you could detect their smell them or something to know.
It was the pheromones they were releasing.
Yeah, you can see what kind of things they'd respond to.
It
didn't quite work in Human Revolution, but no. I think it was a good idea, and I think you could see it being refined to something.
They did say that there would be more choices earlier on in the story, not just the very, very end when they ask you to press a button.
Right, yes.
So the first bit you played, the Dubai bit, is probably the start of the game, do you think?
It felt like the start of the game, yeah.
Do they... at the start of Human Revolution, one of the few bullshit things was that they just give you an assault rifle and they kind of expect you to kill a bunch of people. Like, it's possible to sneak past them, but there's no non-lethal thing. You can't punch them. There's no...
They do the classic Deus Ex thing in the helicopter or the plane. They ask you, hey, do you want to go lethal or non-lethal? And you go, Lethal, please. And then they go, do you want short range or long range? And you go, short range, please. And then they give you, oh, here's a stick.
Considering the choices, it's still a stick. It would have been the stick, really, more or less.
It's always the stick. It's always the stick. No, it wasn't sticky.
Use the pointy end, since it's deadly.
How does the military function in the Deus Ex universe? Can you imagine like a whole troop of soldiers being dropped into the Middle East or something, being told, like, okay, hands up. Who wants lethal? Okay. All right. Now keep your hands up. All right. Yes. Now, wait, how many of you are also long range? Okay. Rest your hands. Okay. Fine. We'll get to you.
We've only got six lethals. Did any of you have a second choice?
Yeah. We've got six lethals. We've got 20 sticks. Yeah. Sticks for everyone.
Who wants non-lethals? One guy.
It wasn't a stick. It was a perfectly lovely gun, which I used extensively.
Was it a trank rifle?
There is both a trank pistol and a trank sniper rifle. Which I played with both.
One thing that MGS definitely has over Deus Ex is the trank rifle is way better, like trank darts in general. Because in Deus Ex, it was so hard to figure out if you'd even hit them, and then if you did hit them, they like, when are they going to pass out? Is it soon? And I remember just trying to play that first level with a trank rifle and just having a nightmare.
You know, my instinct says they've actually copied the headshot system from MGS, but I'm not sure. I played a lot of MGS recently. I might have misremembered that.
Should we do questions from questions?
Why not?
Okay.
Gareth writes in with a very, very, very long email, but he does say that CNC is his favourite podcast, so it's okay that it's that long. He also goes on to make very interesting points about free-to-play games, because he has a system of analysis which he thinks can fairly adjudicate whether a free-to-play game is bilking you or not. And he breaks it down into three factors. How much the game can be earned rather than bought, a basic paywall, basically. What type of items can only be bought? The best are only vanity/convenience rather than game-changing, or those that give you an advantage. The exchange rate, and he says this is a kind of point that he doesn't see people using very much in analysis of these games, but it's about the cost of using the currency of either time or money. So how long does it take you to earn an item that costs, say, £5? Or dollars in the US. Using these three factors, he says, you can review how fair a free-to-play game is. And so he gives them some examples on the spectrum. Battlefield Heroes, supposed to be vanity purchases only, but it turns out you can buy better stuff than you can earn. Almost nothing could be earned, and the exchange rate was disgraceful, i.e. several hours of play only got you a £2 week rental of presumably an item. Planetside of Warframe, he says, two amazing games with most things being earnable and the bought things are vanity and convenience only. They're both on the high side of time/money ratio, though, with Planetside being ridiculous and Warframe starting well, but later things take stupid amounts of time due to RNG. Then Trove, he says, this is the best example of the free-to-play game space. Not only is bought stuff only cosmetic and convenience, but also they have made everything tradable. So a vanity mount can be bought with cash and exchanged with other players for in-game items. So
what is that, do you know? Trove?
It's sort of a Minecraft-alike, I suppose. It's done quite well. I think it's still in early access. I haven't actually played it, but it looks nice. Look, chirpy, fun game. Anyway, so his question is, what do you think about time versus money? Should games consider offering both options for non-gameplay upgrades, e.g. Battlefield, etc.?
Yeah. It's a good point. And it would be good if, like, it's often just trotted out as, everything you can buy, you can also earn, as if that kind of solves the whole thing. But he's right, the conversion rate kind of matters a lot. Like, in a lot of games, it's completely impractical to earn all of the things that you would want.
I think when I have reviewed free-to-play games, I have talked about how long it takes you to earn stuff as a factor in it. I don't know. Do you think the way that people review free-to-play games is adequate at the moment?
I think this is a good system, but I also think that a lot of the time it depends on the type of game it is to such a substantial degree what's going to be acceptable and what isn't. Like, you know, if you're talking about League of Legends or Smite or Heroes of the Storm, you could say you can buy real serious gameplay things in those games because you can buy characters. But the game has been designed to allow that to be the case for the game not to quite fall apart regardless, right?
Yeah.
You know, his model, it particularly applies to RPGs and MMOs and things where you have a persistent character over time, not a character you control for a single match, for example. And so you have to have a slightly different, some of the same ideas apply, but like, I like Smite for offering an option where you can pay £30 to get every character, present and future, because that represents a cap on how much you can ultimately spend, and that's a really good thing. But that's would possibly be considered bad by that particular set of standards outlined, because it'd be like, you can spend £30 to get like 10 times more characters than are available for free. But it's actually a good thing. So there are definitely going to be cases where it doesn't quite work. But I think particularly for the case of RPGs, which apply to Guild Wars as well, I think. It's a good system.
I would add clarity as a factor.
Definitely.
By that I simply mean, does this game deliberately obfuscate through alternative currencies, et cetera, and extremely detailed and complicated ways to buy things and, you know, buying decisions? Does it obfuscate the actual cost to you in terms of time and money, which many shitty free-to-play games do?
How insistent is it on you purchasing stuff as well? Does it kind of shake these gaudy things in front of you until you go, fine, I'll buy it?
One of the things that they're, you know, it's like, here's what you didn't get for completing this round of this game in massive golden, and that's just so depressing. It's just, I just don't play that game anymore.
Still, the worst example ever was when they locked off sprinting in the Old Republic when that game went free to play, and that's a game like that, because technically, like, well, that's actually not too much of a gameplay advantage, you know. Everyone moves, everyone can move. You need to get between your quest objectives 20% faster. You know, if you want that convenience of being able to go 20% faster, you can pay. That's a game fundamentally about running across big open worlds, and it is unbearable to see someone else hair past you on the way to have... basically skipping the boring bit of the game, the rides between places, because they spent a little bit of money. Like, that was... yeah, that was terrible.
Old MGS has just added base insurance as a real money purchase.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck off, really?
So you're forward operating bases can be invaded by other players, which has always been true, and they can steal your staff and your equipment. But now if you pay them real money, pay Konami real money, then all the stuff they steal is replaced for free, and they still get it, but you get to keep it as well.
Weird.
They've also added cosmetic microtransactions, including, completely unironically, horse armor. For 80p, you can dress D-Horse up as a cowboy. You can dress D-Horse up as a kind of Victorian parade horse. And you can also unlock sneaking suits, quote unquote, for female characters. I think maybe Quiet, but presumably maybe just any female character you can play in that game, that recreate the looks of Eva from Metal Gear 3 and the boss from Metal Gear 3.
Oh, right.
Both of whom are women in jumpsuits they've inexplicably opened to the navel. So.
Can you in put general, D-Dog in a jumpsuit that's open to his navel? Or her navel? I don't know. Is it he?
I think it's a he. D-Dog's a he.
Funny enough, like, it's a game where some of the things I would pay for in that quite happily is stuff like I'm playing as this random female character who is not part of the plot at all, and it's a real weird, hacky thing. But if that was like a, I don't know, £2 thing that I had to unlock, I would happily pay for that, because it's totally out of the game. It doesn't make any sense. It's this really
exciting. I was just going to ask you about that. Does it let you play every mission like as her?
Yeah.
Does it? What happens in the cutscenes?
So some cutscenes you're automatically replaced with Snake. Some cutscenes you just stay as yourself, and everyone refers to you as Snake. And like once or twice, you actually have to go and change back to Snake. I think only once, actually. There's one particular cutscene that doesn't trigger unless you're playing a Snake.
Right.
But that almost feels like an oversight. I think they wanted it to work seamlessly.
I'd rather...
I'm already a demon, Kaz. Also, I'm this woman now. Refer to her as me, I'm going.
As shonky as that is, I prefer they gave you the option.
Into a box.
Yeah, I like it. I can... Every time anything weird happens with me playing a different character, I always think, well... almost any other studio would have said, well, now I have to scrap this feature because it's too much work to make it work. And I'm really glad they didn't.
I don't know how to pronounce this person's name. I'm sorry.
Good luck, Marsh.
Ayush Basnet says, hello, coerced cleverness. Greetings from Nepal, land of disasters.
Wow.
It's quite
funny.
Close to the bone. Regarding the BBC special about women in computer science, you talked about on episode 111, you must all be aware a woman was the first programmer, Ada Lovelace. What you might not be aware is, maybe you are, programming was a field dominated by women. But when programming became more of a prestigious profession, women were pushed out of the field because they did not want programming to be considered women's work. And the rise of personal computers also contributed. Parents bought computers for boys, encouraged boys to use it, and excluded girls. Women were less likely to be computer literate when they got to uni because of this. which is obviously discouraging. There is better written stuff about this out there. Check those out. Has put links in the show notes that we'll attribute to them. Sad that we live in not as enlightened times as we claim to be. Thanks for the great show. You're somewhat loyal fan. Ayush, try pronouncing that. I did know that because my mother was a programmer.
Wow.
Way back when, and there was no particular gender discrimination then. It wasn't considered to be a gendered field at all. But this was back when punch cards were the way of programming things. She worked for the post office. Which was also the rail network and everything else because it was all a state-run industry. But I don't know. I think she stopped being a programmer in order to have a family. But I have to talk to her about what the perception of that job was at the time and whether she appreciated a change in that. Because obviously my dad, who's an engineer and worked on microchip design, which is a similar kind of, what might now be called a very male field, certainly his career path has been dominated entirely by other men.
That's true.
There's a very good photo, probably very famous, but it was doing the rounds a while ago, of the woman whose name doesn't come to me right now, who programmed, I think, the landing mechanism for one of the Apollo missions.
Oh, I've seen this picture.
And it's an amazing photo of, I don't know how tall she is. She doesn't look particularly tall. But a woman standing next to a handwritten, set of code books that are taller than she is. And I think the thing she was famous for was she pioneered the use of sort of self-correcting redundancies into those scripts. Which apparently stopped at least one moon thing from going directly into the moon.
Always a plus.
Yeah. Because it had miscalculated where the ground was. And that was something that could be corrected rather than something that had been locked into the script. Right. I don't know enough about the programming involved to know exactly how that had been done, but I kind of understand the vague principles around it. But yeah. So yeah, absolutely. That is definitely a thing.
Yeah, I remember hearing this that the
and the moon is grateful for it.
One less scar on its pock surface. I remember hearing that the introduction to the personal computer was kind of the start of the gender bias in computing. Because it was marketed to boys and boys got given them and stuff. That changed everything.
It's kind of amazing how much this is a marketing problem.
Mm. Yeah.
Generationally, that for whatever reason that it wasn't originally quite so gender problematic as it is now, that it became so because of a marketing decision. What I'm suggesting is that if we could just put a lot of marketing people in the sea, would this get better?
The B arc. Yeah.
Fire them into the moon. Yes.
It is interesting. It was obviously something that happened in the 70s, right? Because by the 80s, it was very much a male dominated field.
Yeah. There has to have been a moment where something to do with computing or the lure of tech was considered to be.
Mm.
Powerful or male or masculine or something.
I haven't watched it this far, but apparently season 2 of the show Halt and Catch Fire is about two women basically making indie games in the
80s. Yeah.
Yeah. So there.
And the moon is grateful for
it. The moon also likes this, unrelatedly.
Casey Clark writes in to say, "Dear group of British men in Bath," which is completely accurate. In the last pod, Chris criticised Life is Strange and similar games, and talked about how they're very linear, lack any feeling of real choice, and he agrees. But it got me thinking about how I actually didn't like playing The Walking Dead or Life is Strange, but I do love watching them and similar games on YouTube. So that he goes on to say, have any of you not gotten along with the game while playing, but found another way to enjoy it, either watching, listening to soundtracks, etc.? Thanks for reading, everybody. He also says, PS, super enjoyed listening to Philippa War on the pod. Cool to have a girl voice. It is cool that Pip speaks with a girl voice. Yeah, it would be weird if she didn't. And opinion. A girl voice and girl opinion among the dudes. Thanks, Casey. We'll pass on your congratulations on Pip's voice to Pip.
Pip's girl voice and girl opinions.
Well done on your girl opinions, Pip.
We've turned a nice thing into something really pretty unpleasant. That.
That was very much my experience with Soma, as hopefully I explained. And I actually even finding the bits, you know, it was the scary bits that put me off, not because they were scary, but because they were boring. And now that I'm watching someone who, as I say, is really engaging with the game and super on board with it, he jumps out of his fucking skin where those things come from. And that's way more entertaining to watch than it was to play.
Yeah, I think I've got to the point now where I quite like the cutscene-heavy sort of games of the Naughty Dog standard, just to watch them happen rather than to play them. I felt that way about The Last of Us, because I wasn't enjoying the combat for the most part of that. Although it did apparently look like it got better, but... didn't like it for the first half, so I just watched it on YouTube instead.
I did play The Last of Us. I also watched Kim play it, but all of the Uncharted series I just watched YouTube videos of because I didn't have the relevant consoles.
They're out next month, actually. They're doing a compilation for PS4 of all of the Uncharted games.
Mm-hmm.
So I might finally play them.
Number two's good.
Okay.
I'll choose Dark Souls as a good example of a game that I'm not going to play five times through to get the lore out of.
Oh, see, yeah.
But if certain experts were to explain the lore as the game was being played to me, then I might enjoy watching.
Joshua says, "Dear mates and bro bars, first, thanks for what you do. I've just finished a six-month contract on a cargo ship where I was the only one interested in PC gaming / a native English speaker, and your mostly pointless banter was nectar to my ears."
I love these kind of backhanded comments.
You're
a semi-loyal reader.
Front-handed compliment, like a close-fist compliment.
He punched you in the face, and then in his hand opened. There was like, "I love you," written inside of his hand.
People with money should give it to you via Patreon, he says. That's literally
totally
something
that.
He says. It's not just something inserted.
Something you can only believe if you've been locked
at
sea.
But you can't check this.
With us as your only source of human contact.
You can't check this is real because it comes from a guy on a ship in no country at the moment and is uncontactable.
He goes and says, "Now that the important questions of finance have been settled, a question! While working at sea, I found I had to uninstall Pillars of Eternity because it had the potential to senselessly consume all my free time. Quests were...
endangering the life of everybody aboard.
Quests completed...
Since I am the captain.
Quests completed being endlessly replaced with new quests, like lopping heads off a Hydra. Even if I didn't have a ton of off-duty duties to attend to, cadets get given so many shitty fetch quests, I think I'd have felt obliged to hang up the old Cursor Gauntlet just so I could do something fresh rather than keep plugging away in the same rut. What games have you forced / considered forcing yourself to stop playing for your own good?" He puts in inverted commas. "Thanks for glistening, scaly bodies." Joshua. I think that's the best one.
And the situation that it comes from suggests that he is either...
He spent, 6 months thinking about that?
No, I'd love to believe that he's got, a little fish tank, and each fish is named after a different one. Or that he's encountered some sort of, elder one in the ocean. Which both are possible. That's my full understanding of the sea.
I would actually just to divert this slightly, some sort of cadet sim where you are literally given fetch quests endlessly on a ship would be an interesting, if torturous, experiment.
I recently listened to a whole podcast about the invention of the cargo container, and it was a total revolution.
It's better and better.
And to the point where, they're standardized, yeah, and the size is determined as just what fits on a lorry. Because the lorry is just a cab and then the cargo container and some wheels.
Mm.
And so things used to have to be unloaded from the containers on ships into new containers and then transported. And now they just take the containers off and put them on trucks.
So is there like
And so 95% of dock staff just lost their jobs. It was fucking efficient.
Oh, wow. Was there one really rich person who owns the patent to these now?
Yeah, there is. He invented it and...
He invented a very particular size of box.
He wanted, it was literally that. It's just like...
Does he rule this?
We just made the box the right size and we didn't have to keep unloading it.
So someone one day went, "Hey guys, but what if the box was this size?" And they're like, "Shit."
And that person's it must have been amazing.
Yeah.
Imagine being all these, because every company in the world who shipped anything had to change everything to match this, because it was just so obviously the right thing to do. They must have all just thought, "Why the fuck didn't we think of this?"
Did you learn this on Stuff You Should Know by any chance?
No, 99% Invisible.
Oh, okay, that's also a good podcast. Two excellent podcasts.
Yep.
If you're stuck at sea.
To his question... have you ever forced or considered forcing yourself to stop playing a game for your own good?
I considered.
Probably to my detriment. I should have done it many more times.
Yeah, I mean, a while back I considered stopping all games when I was questioning whether it was actually a good thing to be spending my time on at all.
Oh God, you can't question that.
Yeah, that's
a blind
something
accept.
You can't come back from. But yeah, I decided that they are basically the best entertainment in the world. there's nothing I find really more moment-to-moment entertaining than video games. Mm. And entertainment is actually kind of precious and special and a good way to spend time, especially if it's with friends.
I think I've considered giving up many of the many competitive things that make me angry. I haven't, and now that's my entire job. The end.
I did actually give up TF2 for that reason. I was getting too angry with it and too competitive, and I thought, like, this is... I wasn't really enjoying it at that point. It wasn't like the highs were high and the lows were low. It was like the lows were low and the highs were like, yes, that's how it should be.
Is it what have I become moment? It's like, I don't like who I am anymore.
Yeah.
I had one of them last night. I just got very, very, very cross at a stupid fucking fella going off on our own, and we very much need to kill the demon guy. Frick.
Tom, not one of the two in front of me, says, hey, Craters and Crumpets. Last week you talked about putting a game on the national curriculum. As a school librarian and boys' secondary school, I actually do use 80 Days in Sorcery as a way of... Sorcery is a game rather than just...
Give me 80 days and a wizard and I will fix those boys.
It works with the 80 days as well. Yeah,
maybe we can go misunderstood.
Sorry, I spilled whiskey on myself. Me and rum.
I think that this is the first time we've completely corpsed, like, to the extent that Marsh can't talk anymore.
I actually do use 80 days of sorcery as a way of getting reluctant readers engaged.
Oh, that's the best sentence we've ever had.
Who in journalism hasn't tried that?
Oh, I'm now certainly thinking about putting the Stanley Parable on the sixth form lit and media studies reading list. It seems to me that games can make a great tool for education. But question, what other ways can we use games? Obviously art and entertainment. But what about documentary? I'm a big fan of the BBC documentary filmmaker Adam Curtis, famous for things like The Power of Nightmares, The Century of the Self, and smaller skits on Charlie Brooker's shows. He uses archive news footage, clips from old ads, films, TV shows, and music, Trent Reznor, for example, to pull together an enticing narrative polemic essay on a political/historical subject. Historical.
Historical.
I don't know what I'm saying.
Historical.
Somebody needs 80 days and some sorcery to set me right.
Teach you to read.
If this is too specific because none of you know his work, then feel free to just vaguely talk about the topic until you get bored.
That's what we're doing in response to every question.
Yeah, that's
from reading my question, you guys. Tom.
Good question.
Yeah, I was going to say that, speaking of the Stanley Parable, Davey Reedon's new game, The Beginner's Guide, is a game where... So it's pitched as, if you go to the website, it tells you it's a narrative first-person game. And if I'd read that and remembered it, I would have known that it was fiction. But instead I didn't. And I played the whole thing, almost the whole thing, thinking it was completely real. And so it plays like a sort of video game documentary. It's about something. I don't want to spoil anything about it, but it's ostensibly studying someone's work. Mm. And I actually thought it really was studying someone's work and just assumed that this was a real person that it was studying. And throughout considered whether that was true or not. And eventually it's clear that it's not. There's a lot of people say, like, just don't read anything about this game, go into it totally fresh. And broadly, I agree with that. But I think it's worth knowing it's fiction because I actually distracted from the game because I just spent the whole time trying to figure out, is this real or is this not? And
it never even occurred to me to question that it was fiction. So I don't know whether it would have been enriched by being uncertain or not. But I think that's a really good comparison to Adam Curtis's stuff, not because it's dealing with really the same topics, but it allows somebody to flit through different disparate images and imagery and draw comparisons and juxtapose them. And that's basically what Adam Curtis does. He draws from a lot of disparate sources and puts them together in ways in which enlighten you by surprising comparisons between them. He's one of my favourite documentary filmmakers. He is technically a documentary filmmaker, but he's more of an artistic filmmaker in that I think a lot of
the problem I have with him actually.
Yeah, I think he's more interesting as he draws narratives about, for example, the Afghan war and its relationship to oil and politics and our relationship with Saudi Arabia and things like that. And I think a lot of the things he's getting at are broadly true. But I think some of the comparisons he makes are sometimes glib and convenient, but sound very convincing because of the way he's presented the material.
Well, I say citation fucking needed, man. almost everything that is in that particular documentary, his latest one. Yeah. I think his latest one in particular is...
I forgot what it's called, man.
It's a short hop.
Bitter Lake.
Bitter Lake is in many ways a short hop from one of those paranoid YouTube videos that...
The Is Jamie Savile a Wizard?
Yeah, the amazing, which we should definitely link, Is Jamie Savile a Wizard documentary.
That wasn't a joke, though. That is a real thing.
It is a real thing.
We watched far too much.
That is, it is 80 days long and about sorcery. it's my favourite thing.
Adam Curtis, I think he's a brilliant artist. He evokes an amazing sense of mood and menace and the way he clashes kind of dancing imagery with a lot of the very serious stuff in that. I'm very affected by it. But from a documentary, I understand that there is going to be bias and stuff, but I expect it as the format to revolve around facts of some kind that are researched, etc. That I can then go and look at and say, oh, he's done his research and all that stuff.
Games should be great for that, though, right?
Yes.
Like,
what the citation stuff?
Yeah, because you can make it interactive or optional or allow people to the degree to which they want to interrogate a particular fact to be up to the viewer rather than something that the documentarian kind of dictates based on their interest in potentially puncturing their own argument or not.
Well, you can have tooltips in games, can't you? You can pause them.
You can pause them.
You can pause podcasts too. Right,
I don't know what's going on there. That was somehow funny. But you mentioned another game that was comparable in the way it flits through.
Yeah, I mean, 30 Flights of Loving and its predecessor to an extent, Gravity. 30 Flights actually is really the one that Brendan Chung, Blendo Games, and that's it's beautiful. It's one of my favourite games ever, actually. Increasingly, the more I think about it, the more I play it again. And that kind of, it thrives on being made in, I'm not sure if it's made in the Quake 3 engine, actually, but like the original Gravity Bone was.
Yeah.
And he's kept it super lo-fi. And what that means is there are just no loading breaks needed because modern PCs can just render that shit so fast.
Actually, it doesn't work on my PC anymore.
Oh, really?
What?
Yeah. Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah, I'm very sad about that.
But the effect is that you get instantaneous cuts in a way that you rarely do in games between entirely different scenarios. And this couldn't happen in Tomb Raider because you have to load textures and you have to load this and the other. And there is just simply a technical problem with the way that stops games from being an Adam Curtis thing. Whereas with 30 Flights of Loving, he's chosen to go back to that old technology. And he still, Brendan Chung creates this fantastic, funny, charming, witty art style, even with the few textures and the few polygons he has. And for that reason, that kind of creating something so good within such constraints, amazing respect for that.
The cut and juxtaposition are the things that make Adam Curtis's documentary stand out. And I think that Brendan Chung is probably one of the only people who've really made good use of that in games.
Yeah. And he's got a background in film, so it makes sense.
No, that does make sense.
Kane writes in to say, quirky greeting! Has there ever been a very simple narrative design choice that a game has made that made a huge impression on you? He mentions The Last Court, which is by whom, Chris?
Fail Better Games. It's the Dragon Age thing. It's the one they did to support Inquisition.
Yes. Oh. He said he thinks that The Last Court's choice to only ever refer to the characters by a description of their archetype, like the Silent Hunter or the Dashing Outlaw, was a brilliant decision. That one choice instantly gives the story the feeling of a fairy tale or legend. It makes all the characters more like players on a stage, which fits really well with how they told that story. It looks like... now, this is the name of a game. My twin brother made me cross-dress as him, and now I have to deal with a geeky stalker and a dom beauty who want me in a bind! ! That game is doing something similar. I played the teaser demo that was recently released, which, as an aside, is doing some rather interesting things mechanically. And the characters all appear to be just described using a single noun. And the definite article. The beauty, the photographer, the stalker, the boy. I really hope that Christine Love, who's presumably the maker of this game, sticks to that and isn't tempted to give them names. My favourite thing about it, I think, is that is the names of you and your brother. Your brother is called the Prince and you're called the Beast. It's great for two reasons. It instantly says a lot about those family relationships, and the Beast really sounds like a nickname you gave yourself rather than one other people gave you, which is hilarious. And the recently released for a real platform 80 Days is a wonderful opening. The thing you see immediately on launching the game, I mean. I won't spoil it, even though it's just two lines of text, but I break out into a huge grin every time I click that dialogue option. Regards, Kane.
It's worth saying that in Failbetter's case, that adjective noun thing for every character is true of all of their games, as far as I know. That's true of Fallen London, and it's true for Sun Must See as well. Hmm. Like, everyone you meet is a wily cleric or a haunted chef.
So they never get names?
No. There are no names. And that's actually, I really like that. I like it for slightly different reasons to Kane. I like it because, it really helps with immersion, actually, because it means that you are, because these games are predominantly text-based with some image, with like one portrait for every character, you're forced to come up with your own sense of the manner of those characters and their, you know, the way they kind of, the way they move and look and talk and everything else. And often I think the less you have to go on with that, the more convincing and specific your mental sense of them becomes. It's a quite a lot like an improv suggestion. Like, if you suggest someone in an improv skit, you know, can we have a suggestion for a character, please? And someone says, Ian! You don't have a lot. It's like...
Haunted Ian. Yeah.
Then you've got something. There you go. Yeah. You know, but, it, you know, Haunted Ian, you get Ian, Haunted Ian, and then Haunted Chef. And Haunted Chef has... Yeah, story spills out of that.
Yeah,
whereas true. Ian is just like...
He's shit, isn't he?
Yeah. Stupid Ian. Sorry, Ians. I've pilled them. But, so there's that part of it. The other thing is that... you get this really nice moment. He mentioned the Dashing Outlaw. And I don't know what everybody thinks when they think Dashing Outlaw, but the Dashing Outlaw in, The Last Court is like like Dick Turpin is the famous highwayman, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. She's like a female Dick Turpin. Hmm. But you sort of know the Dashing Outlaw is coming before I think you see the picture. And so that moment of, oh, it's a woman, which might, you know, based on a lot of fantasy tropes, you might expect Dashing Outlaw means dude, mm-hmm. is a nice little moment of subversion that's a little bit easier to achieve because you're told who the character is, not what their name happens to be, which is actually irrelevant. Because I find this about fantasy in general, like, I think names are such a huge sticking point for fantasy because you either make up nonsense, non-real names in order to make sure that the player doesn't think this is happening in Bristol, or whatever, because everyone's called Ian and Gareth, or Stuart and Mary, or whatever. Or you do go with it, and then you risk that kind of, like, you know, weird fantasy thing everyone falls into, where the name's like, sort of like real names, but kind of not. So, like,
Luke. Like George R. R. Martin.
Yeah, Luke becomes Loke. Or, you know, like, yeah, there's lots of different variants on John in, or whatever. You know, these sort of things. Game of Thrones is a really good example because it has some full-on regular ass names in it, right? There's a John. There's an Ian. There's a Ned, yeah.
There's a Ned.
But no, there's a Ned. But Ned is short for Nedded. He's short for Nedded, which is like rather than Edward. You know, it has these sort of weird things, but there's a Robert. You know, like, and so you have these moments where it's sort of for the sake of giving the characters names. And obviously in a novel, you do need to give the characters names. Well, probably, you know, especially a novel like that, which is so much about dynasty and everything else. But I think in interactive fantasy, it actually really helps to just go off a suggestion rather than a kind of specific name. Like, to the extent that I thought about this when we were doing pen and paper. Whereas, like, because I played a lot of Failbetter games after having tried to solve that problem in my own way, which was giving you guys the names you were allowed to use for your characters and making them as ordinary as possible in the context of the world. Because one of the fantasy sometimes goes the wrong way where it clearly denotes its protagonists by giving them much radder names than everybody else. Like, you know, I'm just a
Don Starkblade.
Yeah. Farm boy.
What was it?
Don. I said Don, his first name.
Don Starkblade.
Donald Starkblade.
It's my next D&D character.
Yeah.
Well, you never say Donald, obviously.
Yeah.
He's Donard, actually. I think you're fine.
The Force Unleashed. Was it Jake Starkiller?
Yeah, Starkiller was like your... Starkiller. No, No, you usually don't find out your real name. Starkiller's your, like, nickname in that.
Oh, okay.
Your real name is... No, your real name is Garen Malik. I'm so fucking regretful that I know that. I prefer sort of, if people have to have names, I prefer to have low fantasy where it happens to be someone whose name is the in-universe equivalent of Tom or Chris that goes on to do things, because that feels more grounded and unbelievable. But I really like Wayfair able to do it, because I think you immediately get a more personal sense of who they are, weirdly, because you don't know their name. And also, one of the things, I think it's very crucial to their games, because their games are built around a repetition, that it gives you the sense that, even though there are definitely, definitely weird problems at those games, where you repeat the same scenario with the same character over and over again, for points, basically, it somehow feels more sort of abstract and emblematic and atmospheric, if it's occurring between your character, who is specific and named, and a kind of, you know, And a sort of almost like an archetype who kind of sits there to be interacted with, it, as Kane says, in a more kind of like theatre-ish kind of ritualistic sort of way.
The Amdram Gang would really dig it.
The Amdram Gang. They love it. They love it. But yeah, no, I think it's dead clever.
100 times easier to remember as well. Like, oh, which was that guy? Oh, it was the Haunted Chef.
Cause, I mean, it's super efficient. Like, you talk about games maybe, I mean, the opposite of this is Metal Gear, which is, you know, like Punished Venom Snake. Formerly Naked Snake, Big Boss, formerly later, yeah.
It kind of has made all adjectives meaningless, that game, just through sheer kind of
volume. I think it's almost got its own sort of thing with it, which is about sort of like naming and language being a bit of a soup and the rest of it in its own very Kojima-y way. It does go in this direction of like, you know, my name is Adamska Shalasaska Ocelot, Revolver Ocelot now, because someone told me to use a revolver to fend off some bees. And that's all meaningful somehow. But it's the opposite of what failed us to do. Because that doesn't live in your imagination. That lives in fucking Kojima's. Mm. And your experience with that game is venturing into his imagination to find out what the fuck he's doing. Whereas, fail better allow the game to take place more in your own imagination.
Mm. I think it's a cool shorthand way of kind of instantly evoking an entire genre of experiences. So I was watching Kill Bill recently, and a lot of the naming in the Kill Bill series is about old martial arts films. And it wants to evoke old, masters in old films, and like Black Mamba and stuff like that, and it instantly recalls, even without you properly thinking about it, that kind of era, even before he massively delves into it and does a pastiche of it in Kill Bill 2. And I think maybe it's the same applies to Failbetter's games, where suddenly that just delves into the whole fantasy archetype and just says, look, this is this person from this, and you instantly understand it.
It's quite-
I can't remember what game does it, but there's a game that where you get special titles for deeds you've done, and you can have as many of them as you like. I think
Fable.
You maybe have to choose which one you have active, but like doing some significant quest gives you that title, and then you can choose that as the prefix for your name. But one of the things I really like in Game of Thrones is Daenerys's endless titles, and the fact that they actually relate to things that we saw her do, and the fact that it's like Queen of the Grasses, and then Breaker of Chains, and Mother of Dragons,
basically.
Yeah, exactly. But having it all built into your name, and most of the time you'll never use the really long name, but then on the formal occasion you get to list all the fucking shit you've done. Do you remember when I did this? Remember how cool it was when I did that? And then I did this.
There's a specific name for those kind of honorific titles. I can't remember what it is.
Epithets?
No, there's something like, you gave me just like style or something like that. Because in the book, somebody complains that, he hasn't been addressed formally. Like, you know, you've got to say your style. You've got to address me by mine or something like that. And it's quite an interesting, they kind of have political weight as well, which is quite an interesting thing.
The term self-styled means someone who describes themselves that way, doesn't it?
It does. I think, there's something very classical about that form of storytelling as well. The reason I said epithet is actually because, In classical literature, that very specifically refers to the
breaker of horses.
Yeah, just fucking up your horses all day long. you go into the stables, they're all broken. Fuck,
snapped them.
It means tamed.
Yeah, I know. What's Odysseus's famous? Is it silver tongued Odysseus?
A few, isn't it? I think like wise epithets meaning wise, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, repeating phrases that are associated with a particular character in oral storytelling.
Rosy finger dawn.
Still funny. But they're usually repeatedly associated with a particular character, which is an like an oral storytelling thing that basically allows the audience that's presumably listening to this as a kind of constant flow of, you know, they can't go back and check something. It kind of constantly reminds you who the character is, as you're saying. Like, that's basically, it's a practical thing. It's like, you know, they have names, but, oh, that's that guy. Like, Big Hitting Steve or whatever.
I really want to do an experiment where, touching on the whole kind of bullshit fantasy names thing, but also just, I just hate, just nonsense words in fantasy in general. And I want to, like, take some video game dialogue, exchanges of dialogue where I just bleep out anything that is a bullshit nonsense name that you can't get anything from, or just a piece of nonsense buzzword crap that
you should
is
just, rather than beep it, you should dub it with what it basically means. Like, villain. Yeah. Or like, you know, but old place.
My problem with it, actually, my problem with a lot of this stuff is that it doesn't evoke that at all. So the actual, like, sadly, as much as I love Destiny, a lot of the year one cutscenes for Destiny are prime examples of this, where you just take them.
I mean, Destiny literally has a moment where a character says, "I don't have time to explain why I don't have time to explain."
Yeah.
Which is his most famous line, but it's gotten better than now, but it mostly got better by making fun of itself.
I definitely, like, there's a load of cool stuff about Destiny. Maybe we'll do a separate Destiny podcast at some point, so we don't go into it too extensively, but it's just word like conflux, which they just say all the time for a lot of missions, and what the fuck is it? That's a word you bleep out, because to the average person that is just a nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, you assemble a conflux into the Vex Gate network, and no one knows what the fuck that is. Well, though, you get really into it, you do. But
exactly. Like, there is a reason for that stuff, but you know, so much goes beyond Destiny. Like, there's so much kind of bad fantasy dialogue where it's just, oh, we need to send McBlah Blah to the buzzword in order to fetch the buzzword to go to the buzz place. And none of those,
that's how bees talk, you know.
None of the actual kind of lingual construction of those words even implies what they are. Like, there are, like, some of the cleverer versions of this actually, kind of trade on Anglo-Saxon terms to give you an impression of what a thing is.
Well, you get a sense of where the word might have come from.
Exactly right, It gives it a kind of a lingual basis somewhere. But, that's so rare in games. So many game scripts are terrible.
I remember thinking about this. Sorry. Whether or not you could do a Bioware game without specific names, but I don't think you actually could. I think that's one, because I think Bioware actually do a good job of actually owning their lore quite a lot of the time, or at least contextualizing it in a way where you accept it. And they do a lot of work to give their NPC characters individual personhood and think of the things that happen to those NPC characters lasting meaning. And that's when names are justified, because also they don't tend to not to reach too far into, you know, in Dragon Age, the characters have names, but, and they are fantasy names, but they don't, they are just the equivalent of, like, you know, Ian, like, or whatever. There's going to be a lot of offended Ians, which is actually would be a good half of a fantasy name. But they work really hard to give them personhood. So, you know, if Garrus in Mass Effect falls out with you, then that's part of your linear story, and you kind of want that to be attached to a person rather than roguish Turian, you know?
They also keep their names to, like, two syllables and with no silly, stupid apostrophe breaks or any of that shit.
So, well, yeah, it's like, there's Talizor and Araya. And then
But like Morden, Garrus, these are like,
these are have short versions of
But actually, everyone calls Tali Tali, because, and they also make a thing of exactly why her name is what it is as well. Like, it is a thing. I think the reason the Failbetters games work is because they have this honest appraisal of what you're actually likely to get out of in terms of personal attachment to characters that exist within what is explicitly a management game. So, you know, striking for personhood when you're talking to, I don't know, the flighty heiress, and every day you go in, you log in, you get your action points, and you spend some action points and 15, you know, happy wishes or something, because it's a Failbetter game, to make the flighty heiress give you an octopus's dreams.
And I do not know these games as well as I thought.
That I think that's fairly reasonably accurate to fall in London. I'll be reductive. Like, if you're like, no, her name is Carol, and you're going to fucking respect her personhood, then the fantasy does crumble a lot faster when you do that every single day, and you're at that point just, you know, mugging Carol for her octopus dreams. Whereas if she's just a flighty heiress, then it's I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about anymore.
Talking of the dreams crumbling, it is the end of this podcast. We've run out of time for questions and also all the time for this podcast. If you want to send us more questions, you can do so by sending to questions@creatingcrowbar.com or going to our forum, which is at creatingcrowbar.com/forum, or tweeting at creatingcrowbar on the Twitters. You can also back us on Patreon if you want to, which is patreon.com/creatingcrowbar, I imagine. Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's good.
Close enough for jazz.
And you can...
That's not true of URLs, usually.
Why isn't that your...
What do with them?
That should be your Twitter name.
It's my favourite phrase.
Or you can follow us individually on Twitter. I'm at Marsh Davis. That's DAVIES.
I'm at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
I'm at PCG Ludo. Aludio.
I'm at C Thurston, CTHURSTEN.
Hope this has been audible. Fun's
Blah, 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 blah.